This is Hacker Public Radio episode 2998 for Wednesday, the 29th of January 2020. Today's show is entitled Hacker Public Radio 2019-20 New Year Show Episode 3. It is hosted by Kevin Wisher and is about 153 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is 8th Annual New Year Show. The US is awake.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Anyone got their ears on?
Yes, I've got my ears on. Just had
Miner.
Just had to shut down something before the push-to-talk key scrambled some editing.
Good evening. Anybody
awake? Hi, Kevin. It's Tony.
Hey, Tony. How are you doing?
Not too bad. What about yourself?
Hello.
I'm doing fine. Minding the stream and kind of started doing some editing on the first episode here, gathering up all the files.
Wow, that's quick work.
I wanted to know if Honky was around, because since he usually does the final editing, I thought I'd talk to him about doing some of it for him.
He's got his mic muted, I think.
So in years past, I don't know when Honky actually took over doing all the editing and publishing, you know, posting all the shows. I know last year, and I see why it takes so long to do this. He didn't get the first episode posted till June.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, there's got to be, you know, he needs some help. I mean, there's no sense in one person trying to do this all himself. And since I saved and scrimped all summer to get myself a brand new computer, I thought I'd take advantage of having this new computer to do all this audio.
Yeah.
And so, but what the dilemma I'm seeing is nobody is filling in the show notes as they go along. And so I'd listened to the first 8.5 hours and the first part of it was pretty good. People did put in some things, and I just kind of filled in the blanks. Well, then after that, it's nothing. I'm used to listening to all my podcasts at 1.6 speed, and to listen to all this at 1:1, and with all, you know, and I'm skipping the big silence spaces, of course, but still, going through 8.5 hours at 1:1 speed and then typing in, you know, some somewhat descriptive show notes. I didn't know if anybody would get really ticked off if we just foregone the detailed show notes. I never look at them.
I don't, not for the New Year shows anyway. Tend to look at the short show, you know, the normal regular releases, but anything over when we're doing the new year, I just treat it as a chat and enjoy listening to what was going on at the time.
Right. If I'm listening, even though I've participated and kind of listened in live, I still listen to the published episodes even then. And then if there's something, you know, a topic that I don't care to listen to, just like any other show topic, if I don't want to listen to it, I just skip over it. You know, it's not that big a deal to me, but I don't want to piss off the community.
and like you say, there's people who look at the show notes and think, nah, that particular new section of the new year doesn't particularly interest me, and they'll they'll wait until the next one comes out. Yeah.
So I guess I could send an email to the email list and ask everybody's opinion, but there's not that many people that actually participate in a poll when you send out a question like that. So I don't know what to do.
How many have we got in the circulation list, in the email circulation list?
I don't know. Ken or...
Ken would probably be out, so...
Ken or Dave would probably be the person, yeah, people to ask about that.
Yeah, if like there was a question about during the year there's been that issue about Creative Commons stuff, and then recently there was something that Ken put out that I contributed to, but quite often what comes around on the bulletins isn't particularly something that I respond to all the time, but if it's a community issue, then I tend to try and respond just to add my voice to the mix, particularly when it's Ken and Dave needing a bit of support on an issue. Anyway, Kevin, what was your new computer?
I went with a Ryzen 8 core. I can't remember the exact number on it, but it actually shows up like it's got 8 when you look at HTOP, with 32 gigs of RAM. And I already had an SSD from my previous computer that I was able to use. All the hard drives I was able to swap over. Mm-hmm. So I just bought the motherboard, the CPU, the RAM, and a new NVIDIA 1032 graphics board.
Ah, reasonable build.
It's the first new computer I've built for myself in a number of years. I do computer repair on the side, and I've always just been able to build myself Frankenstein computers from people's computers that they give me. So
yeah, I got the feeling.
So I just thought, man, I really, really like to have a new computer. And so, I scamped and saved all summer and from some computer jobs. And
yeah. How much did you put it together for in the end?
It also included a new case. It was just over $600 with the case.
Yeah, quite reasonable. Yeah, I'm thinking of either building or getting myself a Ryzen system. I've actually found a computer supplier builder that they're in Germany that ship to the UK, and they build Ryzen systems, and I've seen one that's reasonably priced. Depending which one I go for, it'll be somewhere between about $400 and $700, your money.
Are you comfortable doing it yourself?
I can do. I've put CPUs onto the board and pasted them and everything, but technology's changed so much over the since I last built anything.
There's a website that's called PC Part Picker, and that will walk you through, once you've, like, if you go through, pick out the CPU you want, then it kind of steps you through buying all the other parts that you don't, because I'm like you, it's gotten so outrageous where I don't understand even the sockets and all this other stuff that you got to watch for, like your memory, the memory types and the expansion slots and all this and that. Well, it'll walk you, once you pick your CPU, then it'll only bring up the motherboards that CPU will work in.
Yeah, one of the things, I don't know if it's the same over your neck of the woods, but one of the things over here is if you buy a pre-configured system that you've bought off the shelf, all the parts are tested together. You get a warranty and all that of everything working together. Unless you go to a specific Linux vendor, you're going to obviously get something that's been built for Windows, but you don't necessarily have to have an operating system installed, and all the hardware works together. That's the main thing, and because these companies are buying in bulk, they can probably put a system together that might cost you even $100-$150 more to build yourself than buying it off the shelf.
That probably wouldn't be bad. That's not bad, $100-$150 more for that peace of mind, I guess.
Talking the other way around. It's actually works out about $100-$150 cheaper because they're buying in bulk. And if I buy it just single components and put it together, it'll cost me $100 more to put the same system together.
I see.
Because they get bulk discount because they're buying, you know, they're buying 1,000 sticks of RAM at one go, or, you know, 100 motherboards or whatever.
Right.
So they're getting the best prices. So by the time you add it up, it's either very, very little difference that you can save on, or you can actually get it cheaper if you shop around. The killer is postage, especially if it's coming from across Europe.
Actually, I got lucky with a new machine this year.
Yeah.
Omen 17-inch laptop.
Right. I haven't bought a new laptop. I've never had a new laptop. All the laptops I've ever owned in the last 20 years, best part of 20 years, have always been second user machines.
Well, I'm second user for this. My brother, who's the trucker, found it to be too big for his needs in his vehicle.
Yeah.
So I got a Christmas present this fall.
Cool.
Yeah, it has 12 threads, 250 gig SSD, terabyte, spinning rust, 7200 RPM.
Have you thought about swapping the spinner out for a SSD?
No.
Quite happy.
The boot drive is a VME SSD.
Oh, right. So you've got a SSD as the boot and the 1 gig as the 1 terabyte as the storage drive.
Actually, what I need to do is start loading it up a little bit because running 3 screens, it's got Optimus graphics of YouTube, is just, the machine is loafing.
Oh, right.
I may make it a put some server stuff on it in the background.
Oh, yeah. For my main machine, I tend to go for a tower, and then I use me Dell or one of my Toshibas as the one for use around the house if I'm not in the office.
Well, I'm just saying, this gaming machine, which had Windows 10 on it for a little bit, dropped in my lap, and I'm not going to look. When somebody drops a Clydesdale team in your lap, it's it's a shame to refuse it.
Oh, do right. I had a similar thing happen to me a few years ago. My brother-in-law had a really good i7 machine built for him a couple of years previously, and then he decided, because he was using Macs at work, he decided to go Mac at home and he bought himself an iMac, and he just had this i7 stuck in the corner. I think he had a 22-23 inch flat screen with it, the whole works, and he bought this all-in-one iMac. And we went round for Christmas dinner, and he said, "Oh, I've got this. You do computers, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "I've got this computer that I haven't used for a year because I bought this Mac." He said, "You can have it." And he gave me the whole system. There's about £1,000 worth of gear.
Yeah, well, this one is is a nice system. I've got to figure out what I'm going to do with my 40-inch screen, because I have a limited number of machines that will drive HDMI. And right now, although what I would really like to do is get a Raspberry Pi, put it on the 40-inch screen, and then work with it through some kind of remote desktop app.
Yeah, TeamViewer or something like that.
Yeah, something. Although I'd like to have something that's not, that doesn't require TeamViewer. In the free version, I believe, still registers itself with TeamViewer HQ.
Oh, right. Okay.
The free version also, you can only get like 20 minutes at a time connection.
Well, I've never used it long enough to hit the wall.
It's annoying when you're trying to... I purchased version 12 for my side business support, because it got to the point where they started locking down the free version for the amount of time that you could be connected to. So that's why I ended up bit the bullet and bought version 12. So I'm still stuck with that version, and all my clients are stuck with version 12 because it's not backwards compatible, of course, because they want you to buy the pay for the next version, of course.
Yeah, I'm ideally I'd like to have it come up as another desktop or screen, but I may have to go to something like I used to have it on the tip of my tongue to run independent applications on it off of the my main desktop's keyboard and mouse.
Your LAN, if you want to open up a port on your firewall, but just doing stuff over the LAN, X2Go works good, and also just a straight VNC for, like, can't remember the name of the Ultra VNC, Tiger VNC, I think. Can't remember the specific one, but there's several VNC packages available in all the repos that works real well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got a gigabyte LAN, and the machine will just be coming off of the... I have a switch here, so the Pi would be running right off of the switch. So there's going to be like no latency once we make a first connection. I haven't dealt with X2Go, but I really need to work on getting my computers working as a network instead of just a bunch of computers funneled down into the internet. I don't have very good I haven't developed the technology of cross connection. I mean, I can SSH and everything here. I just haven't gone to that level where the network is worked as a network instead of a bunch of separate extensions to the internet connection.
Yeah, I don't know how to do all that stuff. It baffles me, all that network stuff.
Well, one of the things that I'm looking forward to with Wayland is that they're working on restoring the internet transparency, which X has lost years ago. Of course, I'm old enough to go back to the days when X terms were the new and upcoming thing over at MIT.
All right.
But then again, I'm also I knew some people who were running their student run accounts management on the big Honeywell Multics.
So you didn't answer my question. What do you need a graphical desktop environment on a Raspberry Pi for?
Well, what I was going to do was use it as another screen. And dam. I know barrier is one of, is the new thing for that to allow you to share keyboard and mouse. I'd like to have the Raspberry Pi maybe working on some basic internet references or stuff like that while I'm doing other stuff on a dual screen, on my dual screen desktop. Basically, I'm trying to emulate DisplayLink.
You'd almost be better to, if you got horsepower on your main machine, to spin up a VM, because you'll get more processor power and graphics performance out of that than you will a Pi.
Well, that's just it. I'm looking to have the Pi behave basically as a headless X-term, just another screen. For very, just for reference stuff. And then if I'm going to do motion video, I'll do all of that on my desktop. I don't need a lot of horsepower just to look at Linux Today or what have you.
And why not just open a second browser or another tab?
Because my other machine, because I'd like to keep, I like the multiple screens. I had a lot. I like having just a reference screen and two screens I can run videos on or what have you.
Do you not like, you say you got dual monitors, but do you use multiple workspaces?
No, I do not use multiple workspaces. Maybe I should look into that.
I mean, they're just the new Raspberry Pi is just now getting to where I think that it could be a viable desktop replacement for light duty stuff, like what you're talking about, doing a web browser type, you know, reference, whatever you're talking about, reference. But you could have two or three different browsers running on a desktop or a laptop that's got enough, that's got at least 8 gig of RAM, and be more productive than trying to run a VNC type graphical session to a Raspberry Pi 3 or lower. So I don't think you're gaining much by doing that, unless you want to set up a second PC in place of the Raspberry Pi if you absolutely have to have the other screen. It's all personal preference. I mean, that's just the way I got dual monitors and I use two desktops, two workspaces, so I can have multiple things going on one machine.
Yeah, well, my desktops are first generation APU, AMD APUs, so they don't have a heck of a lot of horsepower processor-wise.
But you're just doing web browsing.
A lot of what I'm doing is web browsing, but I'm running into the wall sometimes on Firefox and whatnot. I could probably get more horsepower out of them, but I'd have to replace the power supply because the machines that I've got are known to have limited power supply overhead for anything like a serious graphics card or whatnot.
But then again, what do you think a Pi has a high-powered graphics processor? I mean, what? I don't understand your reasoning for a Pi versus a standard dual-core computer with 8 gigs of RAM is going to do better than a Raspberry Pi.
The other thing about even the Raspberry Pi 4 at the moment is, even though they've come out with a few firmware fixes, it's still got thermal problems as well. You definitely need to use some at least passive cooling, if not active cooling.
That's part of why I haven't jumped for it. But also, what I'm going to be doing is adding a few brains to my TV, and I've run into problems with driving it off of my ordinary video card. Yes, and I'm waiting for the Pi 4 to catch up with the Pi 3 in some of the video areas. Also, I'm not real chuffed that the Raspberry Pi 4 needs, if you run dual screens, you have to have the same resolution on each.
Yeah, see what you mean. You're supposed to be able to run two screens at 4K, aren't you?
Yes, you're supposed to run at the resolution, but again, the Pi 4 video side is still relatively poor supported. Which is why I would use that for my less challenging applications.
I'd like to take a break here to welcome into the new year for Greece and a few more, Cairo, Ankara, Athens, and Bucharest. Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year.
We're at UTC 2201.
Yep, that's what I'm showing. Next stop, Europe. Well, more west of Europe anyway.
So, Netminer, tell me about your most high-powered desktop unit that you call your work, your main workstation, or even if it's a laptop. Tell me what specs it is. Did he hear me?
I don't know. He's still got his mic open, according to the mumble. I'm just going to dip off for something. I'll talk to you in a bit, Kim.
Okay, see ya.
Guys, well, prowling MIT back in the last century, I ran across a discarded manual for an IBM product to manage OS 360. It was an interesting example in there of virtualization. The basic product required a small 360 to manage a larger unit. OS 360 was a bit of a dog as far as management interfaces were concerned. What fascinated me was that while the basic product used the channel-to-channel adapter and a complete separate CPU to run its management functions, there was a function where the product could be run inside a very large 360 with a virtual channel-to-channel adapter. So one half of the machine ordered the other half of the machine what to do. And all of this was done in a basically a real mode memory environment.
Hello?
Sorry, I had to shut down another application before I could use push to talk without messing up some editing I'm doing.
What are you editing?
Oh, just some old stuff that I wrote. Science fiction.
Wait, you had to shut down editing so you could use audio?
The editor I'm using tended to capture the push to talk key.
Oh, yeah, that would have made sense. What are you using?
Notepad QQ.
Huh. Is that a QT application?
Yes, it is QT, and it's a clone of the Windows Notepad++.
Notepad QQ. Is that Notepad-QQ?
Nope.
Did you have a nice holiday so far?
Oh, it's been very quiet. My back has been kicking up, but it's been extremely quiet. I've just been trying to keep my back working and just get through. Don't have many relatives in this area, and my nearest relative's a couple hundred miles away, and I don't drive.
I take a lift, right? A hat would be really expensive.
Yeah, also, it's an elderly aunt, so it would be an intrusion.
So is what text editor, like what so is Notepad QQ your preferred text editor for everything?
Well, I like it because it has a variable font and some visual cues and stuff. It's fairly simple.
Do you use it for just more than editing your writing, or do you use it for like configuration and administration too?
No, for configuration stuff, which I don't do much of, I use Nano. I'm definitely not an Emacs or Vim guy.
Do you have difficulty switching to other like text editors or just anything that does text input after you've been using any, you know, your preferred application for a while?
I don't have problems. I don't touch type, and I've been doing text editing since back in the days of DOS, so I've handled probably half a dozen or a dozen editors with different characteristics.
I personally prefer VI Improved, and I'll tell you what, anytime I get into another editor, it's just, I can use them, but I always end up like trying to find whether they have a Vim mode, and I enable that, and then eventually I just go back to using VI. Because where I work, like, people are like, they all swear by either WebStorm or Visual Studio, the new one. Is it Visual Studio Editor? Is that what it's called? Is that the new one that is cross-platform? Kind of works like Google Atom or even WebStorm or whatever. Eclipse has got a plugin for just about almost any language, syntax highlighting, code completion, garbage like that.
Well, I haven't been doing much programming, and I certainly haven't been keeping up with the modern Microsoft stuff. As I said, I have not soaked myself in either the cult of Vim or the cult of Emacs.
I like to try, like, every couple of months, learn a new feature of VI Improved. Some people call it Vim, some people call it VI Improved. I don't know what the correct way to call it ever is. Some people get bent out of shape if you call it VI. So you got VI and you have VI Improved, and they're not the same thing. Because if you view Slackware, you get Elvis, and Elvis is, I think, the default on Slackware. I think even Ubuntu defaults to, there's certain features that you have to install for VI Improved, and there is a subtle difference, things that if it's just pure VI or Elvis or another derivative and you're used to VI Improved, it might not work in the same way that you expect it to.
Yeah, well, back in the day when I was doing more programming, I was fascinated by writing my own plain text editor, and I studied a lot of, you know, a lot of that. And I'd like to tackle it again, but I'm not really interested in going down the rabbit hole of trying to deal with X Windows or what have you, or even the X-term.
What were you writing your own text editor? What language were you writing that in?
Power Basic.
Oh, wow. What platform are you writing it on?
DOS, and I was also working with Free Pascal on an extended DOS platform.
Oh, neat.
But trying to retrofit MS-DOS with long file names and some of the other features that Free Pascal really needed was quite hairy.
I take it Pascal is still around, isn't it?
Oh, Lord, yes. Although nowadays they've gone into a more Delphi'd version called Lazarus.
Was Delphi the one that did was that Pascal? Delphi put that out? Or was that just one version of Pascal?
Borland had their Pascal, which went object-oriented. And when they jumped to serious Windows support, and when Windows grew into, you know, more protected mode stuff, they went to something that they called Delphi. And now the Free Pascal, which started out as a Turbo Pascal compatible, has also jumped to the object-oriented rapid prototyping, whatever you want to call it, of Delphi.
No, at least Lazarus is still going strong. 2.0.6, released November 1st, 2019.
Well, Free Pascal 3.2 is coming out.
Yeah,
sometime soon.
Sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, it's coming out sometime soon.
All right,
it's not a bad language, but getting it, learning how to hook it into a user interface is a little tricky.
Yeah, Free Pascal had some updates on July 20th, and they said then 3.2 should be out later this year. If it's not coming out today, I guess it's getting bumped for next year or tomorrow, 2020.
I believe that they have a sort of Debian view of releases. We'll release it when it's ready. Although I would like to try Free Pascal under FreeDOS, since FreeDOS has or can be configured with long file names and large file support and a partridge in a pear tree.
So looking at the Free Pascal overview and the supported architectures, pretty interesting. Nintendo Game Boy Advance, DS, Nintendo Wii are included on there. I guess you can you compile an application for any architecture off of any architecture? Like, can you compile a Game Boy Advance executable in Pascal from a Linux machine? Or do you have to compile it on the architecture you want it to run under?
Well, I only know that, there are cross-compiler stuff, and I'm sure that a lot of the stuff is cross-compiled for some of the architectures like ARM or whatnot. But I'm not really sure of the details.
Interesting. I wonder how Fortran's doing.
It's still grinding along. They're still putting it out there. COBOL's still out there. Yes, I'm a antiquated language geek.
So I remember back in college, like, there were, I wasn't in computer science, but I know engineering and stuff like that did a lot with classes on Fortran, and I'm not sure if they had Pascal classes too. Wow, that was a long time ago.
Well, at UMass, Pascal was the teaching language of the time. Coming in from CPM and DOS, I had been exposed to BASIC, and Power BASIC was quite powerful. It reminded me a lot of a DEC RT Fortran.
I wonder what they're using to teach now. Is it still like Java? I guess it is. I know, you know, actually, my daughter's fiance, he was in their computer science classes a couple of years ago. Well, the past couple of years, they were doing Java, I think some Visual Studio, Microsoft C++, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe C Sharp, probably.
Yeah. And Python, I think. Yeah, there was Python, too.
What I found interesting when I was talking to some people who were being taught computer science via Visual Basic. Please spit over the side if you have to. They hadn't discovered or covered things like rounding errors.
Oh, man. That could be a huge problem.
Yeah, well, after I had been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, I went to a quickie teach them Office course under Windows 2000. And I was, you know, I'd like to play around with Access because I'd never played with a database before. But they were very upset about that. And when I tried to convert a Word table back to text and Word threw up all over the floor, they were very mad at me for abusing Word.
So wait, you were programmatically taking a table created in Word and converting it back into text?
I was asking Word to convert it back to text.
Okay.
I thought this thing was a text editor that supported plain text that should convert itself both bidirectionally.
Yeah, you learned pretty fast that didn't work out, right?
Yes, and of course, when Word throws up on your shoes, it's your fault that you broke the Word. It can't be that Microsoft Word has some bugs in it. It's from the gurus at Microsoft. They don't produce buggy software.
Absolutely not.
Now I should wash my mouth out with soap. But
what version of Word was that? Do you remember?
Probably Word 2000.
Okay.
The most useful stuff that I've done since I left paid work in 1997, February, was spent a couple of years working at a computer internet cafe up in Somerville. Unfortunately, our governing body was not into fundraising. They were into going to governance meetings and having their little party and whatnot, but when it came to actually raising money, they didn't sign on for work. Of course, one of the people that was involved also helped sink the Boston Computer Society, so I guess we were in good company. Now, we kept ourselves going by assembling from junk parts Windows 2000 PCs. And that one copy of Windows 2000, well, amazing things happen if you leave the Windows 2000 CD-ROM set in the dark.
It multiplied itself across many machines?
Yeah, since our list price for a complete system was about $200. Yes, we are one of those people that, why Microsoft XP has all of those. Register with us, please, or we won't let your system install.
I mean, remember back in the day when, like, like Windows 95 and then 98 and then 2000 came out, and there was like lines at the store on release day for to get a copy of it, and everybody was all excited. It was big news. Did that happen for XP also? Like, I don't remember it being. Maybe it did. Or was XP the last?
XP was one of the. Was Windows 2000 with, well, it had higher system requirements, but you actually got a fairly decent system for your money. Now, it didn't support the DOS box, but it did pretty much everything anybody really wanted. You know, you could get a decent browser, you know, Firefox or something. And it had the journaling file system, so if it crashed, you didn't lose work, just like, you know, Linux does. And if you had a machine with a little horsepower, you know, a gigahertz or so, it would be nice. It was so nice that Microsoft really had to kill it with fire to get people to move to Windows 7.
XP was the, I would say, the operating system that destroyed Novell. As I remember, at the school district, we were a Novell shop. And XP came out, and that just was not playing nice with Novell. And Novell client would update, and then Microsoft would update and break compatibility and things. It was just like a moving target every time.
Well, yes. Also, XP, well, the first consumer operating systems available from Microsoft that were what we would consider operating systems, protected mode, multi-core and whatnot, were Windows 2000 and Windows XP. Also, XP and Windows 2000 are why Samba became a thing. Because people could have their XP machines talking to an older Windows 98 or what have you machine running a Linux and Samba, and they would get the same benefits as they got from a work group Windows Server. You didn't get Active Directory, but for a lot of people, you didn't need Active Directory. You just needed somewhere to put the big disks and to do backups fairly regularly by somebody who knew what he was doing.
Oh man, I remember the joys of getting all that stuff to work. Windows 98, Windows XP, and Novell all together. Oh boy, was that a joy.
And Windows 2000, which I understand if you did a clean install, was fairly decent. If you did an upgrade install, there was a lot of decaying Windows in the background.
Has that always been a problem with their stuff? I mean, I have to say, I haven't used anything significantly from Microsoft since Windows XP.
Well, I went from XP. My original desktops were Windows 7, and that was fairly decent. Until Microsoft started sideloading Windows 10.
How do you like Windows 10?
I'm running Ubuntu on those machines.
Well, there you go.
Windows 10, otherwise known as ET Phone Home, may be a decent system, but the fact that you basically give root to Microsoft turned me off big time.
So my actual experience with Windows 10 was recently in that my daughter, one of my middle daughters, got a laptop I didn't purchase that had Windows 10 on it in SP mode. And, well, I didn't know what was on it because I didn't buy it. She got it for Christmas and I didn't buy it, and I had complete hands off of it. And she came down and she said to me, I want to get Google Chrome installed on here. And I said, why not Firefox, right? Now, and so she's like, but it won't let me install it because it's in SP. And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about because I don't do Microsoft. But I took a look at it, and I'm like, it's what? That's some kind of protected mode, right? Secure protection mode or whatever it is. I don't know. So I went on. I like
Windows at, for bigger idiots than usual.
Yeah. So I went online on their FAQ, and it says, here's how you turn SP mode off. Because she kept saying, it wants me to put in the code, you know, that whatever that the license key, right? So there's no license key on the system. They don't have the sticker on the bottom. And I'm like, okay, so I go looking at the box, see if there's anything in there. There's nothing in there, right? Because when she brought it down to me, it's in there telling her, if you want Windows Professional, you got to put in your license key for it. And I'm like, wait a minute. So I went back on site to, it's a Lenovo. I went to the Lenovo website to see, and it comes with Windows 10 Home. But I went to where she got it from, was Amazon, and it said it ships with Windows 10 Home in SP mode. So the fact says that you could just go in and turn off SP mode, and you're good to go. But you have to do it through the Microsoft Store or something like that. And the way you get into it is like settings, security, and then other options. And I followed the directions. It didn't match anything that I had to do to go through there, right? Completely nothing matched, even their own documentation. Like, I knew enough to get where I wanted to get to, but following their documentation didn't get me there. And when I got there, it turns out that she had already had it disabled. I don't know what she did. So I was just going around in circles, and I don't know what her problem was, going around in circles. So if you're in SP mode, you can't install anything unless it comes from the Microsoft Store. And I thought, well, okay, do they have Google Chrome in the Microsoft Store? Nope. Do they have Firefox in the Microsoft Store? Nope. But for people who don't know any better, they do have Google Chrome and Firefox manuals in Microsoft Store. And it's like the icon of Firefox or Google, and it says Google Chrome or Firefox, and then underneath it, it says manual in a smaller type and font, and it costs like $3. And I'm like, who the hell would pay $3 for Firefox or Chrome? Oh, it's a manual. Who would pay that for any of those things? That's even more of a ripoff. What a terrible experience.
Well, not only that, I reset a machine, an Omen desktop, after my brother gave it to me, and then it came to basically re-register the machine. And Microsoft wanted, you know, what you had for breakfast last night. They wanted all sorts of details, and I said, no, thank you.
Holy moly.
Not only that, Microsoft violates daily the any kind of professional privacy standards in the country. Because HIPAA says that you're not supposed to allow unauthorized users to access to my records. Microsoft does not limit their ability to scan your entire machine if they like it. You confidential files? Sorry, Charlie. There are no confidential files from Microsoft.
That's the price you pay, right? That's what they say, the price you pay for business.
And yet, when I talk to the medical professionals, they have no idea what they're doing. Of course, my medical professionals also do a lot of their work over Wi-Fi. Sure, you want to transmit confidential results over an insecure link. I had some hope for WPA3, but evidently they've had some serious security holes.
Do they have, like, when was it supposed to be out?
Well, they've been banging on it for a while. It's been sort of out for a while. I don't know how long, but I've heard that it's far more Wi-Fi than secure Wi-Fi.
That's gonna be a treat, huh? Gotta go and either upgrade your firmware or get a whole new Wi-Fi access point.
Well, I think that's where a lot of things like Raspberry Pis are going to go if the chipset allows it.
To be used as an access point or WPA3?
As an access point. You have a ton of processor and you have a reasonable chunk of memory and you have a gigabyte Ethernet port and you have USB 3 to run whatever dongle you need to run to provide better Wi-Fi than the onboard chip.
You got big plans for 2020?
Not really. I'm just trying to. I'll be working to get my back in shape, and I may go back into treatment for my Asperger syndrome and depression, but this time I'll look a lot more carefully at the professional I entrust my counseling position to.
So your Asperger's, was that a recent diagnosis, or have you had been aware of that a long time?
I got diagnosed with something by a a buddy who said your body language is just not, it's completely off the wall. Then in 2003, when I went in for nerves because of family situation, I got tested and they uncovered Asperger's syndrome. Then I went to my to what turned out to be my counselor for an evaluation, and we spent, well, the last 15 years or whatever it is, working on my situation. However, I found my counselor had certain notions which didn't, that I found quite unhealthy. In fact, it took tremendous willpower to drag my ass into the session because I knew that my counselor was going to misinterpret everything I said. And trying to get through her perfect treatment plan was turned out to be not worth it in the long run.
Hi, everyone. I made it back. Netminer, I understand what you're going through. I told my therapist when I was 12 that I was autistic, and he said, oh, no, you're none of that. And it wasn't until I was like 55, 56 before I got someone, before I showed them the results of my testing that I did myself. And they said, oh, yeah, you got a point there, don't you? In the meantime, they've been treating me for everything else under the sun, quote, treating, end quote, with some of the most wonderful drugs. That left me pretty much disabled for quite a long time.
Well, I was being treated by a vegan Clintonista.
Yeah, I tend to get the guys that say, here, take these nice, wonderful drugs that, we don't know anything about long-term effects. They've never been tested for more than 6 months to 2 years, but you'll be taking them the rest of your life. I took myself off all of those in November of 03, or that's the last one I took was November of 03. And I've been getting better ever since, amazingly.
Well, I should be more regular with some of my pills, but when your primary mental health professional, is that difficult to deal with? The entire psychomedical thing is a little hard to swallow.
I hear you.
Also, she was a PhD, and I didn't graduate college. And her PhD told her that she knew what the real world was, including somebody on disability should rewire their house and insulate it and generally convert it to the same kind of house that she had up at Newburyport.
Yeah, the neurotypicals just don't understand we neurodiverse types, and they think that we can do all the things they can do, even though we can do things that they can't.
Well, also, I'm a, my folks were from small towns in West Virginia and Maine, and they raised me as a 50s kid. Now, you want to find stranger in a strange land, have somebody with conservative views in the Boston area.
Isn't that called Mitt Romney? Okay, I think someone earlier had said that politics is probably not the best topic for today.
Yeah, well, I used to be a Republican, now I'm independent. Basically, a curse on both your houses. Though I am finding the House of Representatives at least mildly amusing. And, you know, I think things, should the papers be delivered to the Senate, which is not a guaranteed feature, things will be amusing when the fact checkers start checking the alleged evidence. But if we want to turn off the politics, that's fine with me. I'm just a stranger in a strange land here. But I've been that way so many I'm slightly dyslexic, all sorts of things.
Yeah, let's stick to something a little more neutral like Brexit.
Well,
I'm sorry, that was tongue-in-cheek so far that my cheek is sticking out halfway across the room.
Well, I'm looking forward for the first time in a long time to the House elections fall of this coming fall. I suspect we will find that we've been infected with Brexit fever.
Well, I spend enough time yelling at my Windows friend. I don't know what they're talking about. And let's leave it there.
Well, I think a smart Democrat would run in 2024. Bailing out, you know, that's like missing the Titanic. Maybe a healthy thing.
So, tried any good distros lately?
Actually, earlier this fall, I had an interesting adventure with my Omen PC with Optimus Graphics. I went through a whole bunch of them, and I found that Linux Lite would actually stay up long enough for me to install the Optimus Xorg, NVIDIA's Xorg, and the system wouldn't throw up over APC or whatever, over power control events that it was not ready to handle.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, Claudio.
Hey, Claudio.
Hey, what's going on, Dan?
How you doing, man?
Doing good, just chilling right now, waiting for the midnight hour, basically, just like everybody else that's still waiting.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to stay up that late since I have to go to work tomorrow, of all things.
Well, that stinks.
Yeah, there was a New Year's party I was invited to that was going to be like 1 to 5 p.m., and I'll be working 9 to 6. I work for O'Reilly, don't you know? We have to have our auto parts.
Well, I thought you were going to say O'Reilly. No, wait. I was going to say, was there a virus scan named O'Reilly? No, there wasn't.
No, I thought he was talking about the publishing.
No.
Yeah, that's right.
Not the publisher. The auto parts from the Irish stronghold of Southwest Missouri. Although I live outside of Knoxville, for those of you who don't know me.
Well, my brother's virtual home is in Missoula, Montana. His actual home is a Volvo truck.
Does he stay in one place or does he move it around?
Well, he stays generally in the lower 48.
He's a truck driver.
Yeah, a Volvo truck.
Yeah, I'm thinking of he lives in a Volvo, and I'm like, that's kind of small, but okay. But no, it's a truck.
No, the Volvo truck is a different beast.
Yes.
Yeah, we've got a number of fans of Mintcast and Distro Hopper's Digest that are truckers, and I hear from them.
Well, he's someone could say addicted to Windows games, so he's still running Windows 10. Which has been quite helpful to me.
I ran Windows 10 for about 10 hours until I found out that no matter how many security holes I plugged, there were still some open. And then I backed it back up to Windows 7, and then I saw that it left all those security holes open again, and I loaded Linux Mint 17 and have not gone back.
Well, I was saying that I'm going, you know, I was on Windows 7. Perfectly happy Windows 7 user. Running a lot of open source software through, if you have somebody who runs Windows, point them at the portableapps.com website. It will save them from the minions of Microsoft in so many ways. They can actually get, you know, LibreOffice that automatically updates. a cast of thousands, all now, free.
When I was running Windows 7, I had KDE 4 Win installed.
Yeah, I was playing with that and stuff. But what drove me nuts was the assault on Windows 7 by Microsoft. Everybody's converting to Windows 10 because we won't let them do anything else. And I bailed into the world of Linux, and I've been there ever since.
What's your main distro?
Ubuntu XFCE in some flavor, Xubuntu, Linux Lite. I experimented briefly with Plasma Neon, but that machine is currently shut down, well, unused. And because it uses Policy Kit, I don't know if I'm going to stay with it and learn how to update things with Policy Kit or jump to something like a BSD running XFCE.
If you're looking to run a BSD that's kind of desktop oriented, I check out Ghost BSD.
Yeah, that's the one that I've been thinking about. Although, unfortunately, I will have to run the community edition because their primary edition is GNOME or something.
Yeah, I think the default version is Mate, and they have a community supported XFCE version. There's also another flavor that came out called Fury BSD, which kind of takes the place of Project Trident. And I don't know if you've heard about Project Trident. They used to be what was PCBSD, which then became TrueOS, which then became TrueOS went back to its roots, and then Project Trident was supposed to be the continuation of that. But then I guess the lead developer decided to switch over to Linux, which kind of defeats the purpose of the whole project, in my opinion. So someone decided to take, I believe, I haven't looked too much into Fury BSD, but it's basically the continuation of that, as far as I know.
As I understand it, the tools that Trident was using that they wanted to be using kept getting denigrated in the BSD that they were working, and finally they found that, well, they could go back to all their favorite tools if they just switched to Void Linux. And that's where they are now.
Void Linux is heavily based on BSD, right?
Well, it probably has some similarities. I just heard the guys on Choose Linux did a review of it recently. And Elle was saying that it was so effective in teaching her the really base type of Linux that next time her Arch friends are telling her, you should try Arch, she's going to have you tried Void.
Cool. Yeah, I was kind of dismayed at hearing them switch over to Linux, because it just seems like it's another Linux distro. But, you know, hey, they got to do what they got to do. It works for them, I guess.
Well, being as how one of my two podcasts is Distro Hopper's Digest, having another Linux distro is a good thing for me.
Well, there's that too. Fair enough.
I mean, we're not going to do a show where we're just looking at all the different Ubuntus.
I sort of liked Plasma. Nice system. But when I updated Ubuntu, I liked having the apt system available like God intended.
Well, you might want to look at the new version of Farin OS, which just came out a few days ago, where it's mostly Plasma, but they've got Aptitude and they've got the Linux Mint program manager, and it's a different thing. It's really nice. They did a good job of putting all these parts together, and so you've got Plasma without Discover, although Discover has come a long ways and it is better. It's still, in my mind, a lot harder to use and takes up a lot more screen space than any of the other program managers such as Mints or Ubuntu's.
Well, I was looking at the basic command line stuff. Also, there's a utility called UCare Core, which is very usable under regular Ubuntu's, that does a lot of automatic updates. It's a console application, but it will also take out a lot of the trash for you. It will trim your kernel tree, that is to say, it will remove kernels that are several generations old, stuff like that. And you just sudo ucare system core, and it just goes off and does its thing, and then it will tell you whether you need, generally tell you when you need to reboot or something. And having something like that that could work with KDE would be great. One reason I like GhostBSD was that it still had UFS instead of ZFS.
Do you have the option during the install to use ZFS? I haven't actually played with GhostBSD yet. I've been busy basically with the vanilla FreeBSD and OpenBSD on myself.
You have the option of using ZFS, but maybe I'm misinformed, but ZFS not only has a completely new tool chain, but you have it tends to compete heavily for memory. And I only have 16 gigs in this APU system.
Yeah, I had actually set up two servers at each of my sites. I set up a server at each of my sites, actually, because they were running old Windows Server 2003. And so obviously they needed to be taken offline. So I decided during the summer break, because I work in the K-12 doing IT, so I decided to take some servers that were decommissioned already and drop FreeBSD on each of them. One was a Dell PowerEdge 2900. That one I was actually able to set up with ZFS. And at my other site, it's an HP ProLiant DL350, I think, G5. And that one, unfortunately, I couldn't use ZFS. I had to actually stick with UFS. Some issue with the built-in RAID controller that it had. So, but it's working. Both of them are working. Nobody can tell the difference. They can access their file shares without a problem. So long as it's working for them, that's working for me.
I mean, I know that ZFS has a lot of things for the server side of the world, but since my machines generally live in the desktop side of the world, I'd like to, have what, and they're not big memory machines by today's standards. I really like the idea of having a somewhat traditional file system. And if Farron sounds like the right thing, it would be nice to stay with an Ubuntu or a Debian type foundation system and not have to go too far off the reservation.
Yeah, I mean, I have ZFS installed. I actually have it installed. I have FreeBSD 12 installed on an old Dell laptop, which I believe I have running with 4 gigs, and it's using ZFS, and it seems to be handling it okay. It's a Dell Latitude D620. I haven't noticed that much. I mean, granted, it's an old machine, but the performance on it actually is not bad. I still have a lot to learn when it comes to ZFS. ZFS is there's so much to it. I gotta get what is it? This book, It's by Michael W. Lucas. He has a book on ZFS, a ZFS mastery or something like that. I don't remember the title off the top of my head. But that I'm going to look into getting that and try to learn a little bit more about it.
Yeah, ZFS, it is not a file system as those coming from regular Windows or regular Linux is concerned. It is largely a storage server of itself. In other words, your operating system has another operating system under it.
Well, anyhow, I've tried Farron a number of times over the years, and the current version seems to get everything right that it wants to be getting right. And if it works for you, that's great. I've got more of a desktop mentality than it sounds like you do, but that's all right.
Yeah, that's why I would like to have a desktop that runs underneath an apt-based update system, and the pretty stuff is left, you know, the desktop is the desktop, and system management is more traditional.
Yeah, well, Farron definitely used the app-based stuff. As I said, they basically use the Linux Mint software manager, which is just a prettied up Synaptic for the most part.
Well, I've used Mint on some of my machines. You know, I like standardizing on, generally I'd standardized on XFCE because a lot of my machines were either older single cores, P4 Celeron, single core Celeron. I even have a Sempron 64 single core.
Well, I have been amazed that Plasma has gotten to be a lightweight desktop. Every test I've seen has it within like 10 megabytes of what XFCE has. And for all the eye candy that's included in it, that seems rather hard to do, but they've seemed to have managed it.
Yeah, well, I like the look of it, but when I started saying I'm going to have to learn a whole new update language, I said, wait a minute, am I getting bang for my buck here?
Well, I don't think you have to use a new update. I mean, if you're using KDE Neon or Kubuntu or anything, you can still go into your terminal and run all the apt commands. It's just they like running it through Discover. And I have been able to use the GDebi package installer instead of Discover when I set it to do that.
Well, again, I loaded Neon, and they say, sorry, you've got to have stuff that's package kit friendly. We do not really support aptitude or apps, whatever. Those are emergency tools that are depreciated.
Deprecated, but that's close enough. I don't know. I run Neon, and it's basically just Ubuntu. If it works in an Ubuntu, it'll work in Neon. You just have to ignore the KDE tools and use your terminal or set things up to run off of apt instead of Discover.
Well, I was, again, I'm not that, I'm a pretty shallow Linux guy. I mean, I have a lot of old knowledge, but I don't have a lot of detailed knowledge about reconfiguring it. When I go to the web page and they say, sorry, you've got to do it this way instead of the way you've been doing it for, you know, several years, I tend to believe.
But you don't have to. It's Linux. Freedom. Yeah.
Yes, but I didn't know how. Well, first, I would have to dig in to reconfigure things that under other systems I don't have to reconfigure, which is why I'm moving to Farron. Okay. Also,
well, sudo apt update works in any terminal, even console.
As I said. And look around for UCare system core. You'll like it. And it will just sit there and update your system. It's basically apps plus some programming. It's not a big system. It uses stuff, you know, everything we got in the background, but it's generally fire and forget.
Now, Claudio, I've heard Leo mention you a few times on Mintcast. I'm trying to remember under what auspices.
Oh, interesting. I was not aware. I can only imagine maybe Mastodon, because I'm on there.
That could be it, yeah. I'm sideloaded into Mastodon. When Purism said that they were going to offer some things for free, I went for them, you know.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm on the Mastodon.xyz instance as Claudio M. So, and yeah, I've recorded a couple episodes on Hacker Public Radio, though I haven't done any within the last maybe year. I'm hoping my New Year's resolution for 2020 is going to be record more episodes for Hacker Public Radio.
Yeah, I don't get on HPR much, except when we started doing Mintcast, HPR had a room for us to use, and we used it up until, about 4 months ago, when our boy wonder, Josh, went and set up our own website with its own space and set up our own Mumble instance. But then 2 weeks ago, our website was down for some very odd reason, actually a pair of very odd reasons. Used HPR's Mumble again to do a show. We are very grateful. Other than that, the only instance I've had of using HPR was when Tony Hughes and I started doing DistroHopper's Digest. Our first episode was actually re-released as an HPR special episode.
Yeah, I've seen that done a number of times, and it's actually kind of neat because it promotes other podcasts out there. There's a few, I remember there was, maybe 1 or 2 years ago, there was the Alien Brothers podcast, and I heard about them through HPR. Because some of their episodes were there, and I was listening to them. I don't know whatever happened to them. I guess they just pod faded or what, but I remember hearing them through that, and I was curious to listen to them outside of that. So it's a good kind of like a gateway to other podcasts when they're promoted, at least the initial episodes, maybe on HPR.
Well, also having such a friendly lifeboat comes in handy.
Indeed.
Yes, someone was talking earlier today about their podcast You Random, which was through HPR and then isn't, and I can't find it on my podcast app, so I just looked for it.
That's Taj and Pokey. They do that. They had me on, I would say, about middle of this year. They had asked me to come on and I joined them, but I hadn't listened. I keep forgetting about them. I hadn't added them to my podcatcher.
Well, I've got Antenna Pod open now, and they won't find You Random for me. So kind of hard to add a podcast you can't find.
Well, Taj, we're calling you out here. We need the info on You Random. But
yeah,
I know you can put in. You can manually put in the link for a particular podcast.
Yeah, we had to do that with DistroHoppers for a while until the podcatcher said, oh, wait a minute, we've seen that before.
Oh, I was just remembering some of the other podcasts I'd been around. Dev Random. Oh, there's one that I can't remember, but it's amazing. I'm now on Linux Lugcast, and I'm very happy to have a home.
Sorry, guys, I had to drop off for a bit because my son just got home. So they were helping out their grandfather with something, I guess preparations for a get-together for New Year's. So I was at the door, so I probably missed whatever. I definitely missed whatever you guys were talking about in the last maybe 30 seconds.
They were talking about this horrible podcast a few years ago called Linux Basement. Terrible.
Remember that? I agree. Man, that was horrible. That was horrendous.
You talk to Chad anymore?
Nah, we've lost touch. We've lost touch. I still have him connected to me via LinkedIn, but I haven't seen anything from him.
Well, he's doing well.
Well, that's good. That's good. I know I've heard mention, I don't know if maybe it was on Tilts, that you know, during SLF or during OLF, that he had shown up to one of them, you guys met up with him or something like that.
Yeah, we went to, we were at SLF, he and I drove down there, not this past year, I think it was the year before.
Ah, very good.
Yeah,
speaking of SLF, speaking of SLF, I'm hoping to make it in 2020. So that's the plan, whether it be just me or with my boys, I'll figure it out somehow, but I'm going to be there.
I tried so hard to get there last year. They even started a fundraiser to get me the money to get there. And it it didn't make it. And 2019 has been a much worse financial year for me than the previous years. So maybe I'll get there this year. It's not that far to Charlotte. One of the biggest problems is that there's a really good science fiction convention in Charlotte, either the same weekend or a weekend before or weekend after, depending on the year. And if I could manage to afford to go to Charlotte once, I can't go two weekends in a row. That's for darn sure. And I usually don't manage to get to Con Carolinas anyhow.
Well, Claudio, yeah, it's the 12th to the 14th in 2020. I don't know when your kid's school ends, but that's like right in the week when my kids always end up getting out of school, and it's so hard to get there.
So in June, is that?
Yes, June 12th to the 14th, 2020, at the Sheraton Charlotte Airport Hotel.
Well, they might actually be off already by that time, which is good. I just don't know if I have them with me that particular weekend. If I do, then I'll take them with me. We do a road trip. And if not, then I'll just go on my own. So I'll figure it out. I may drive again. This time I'll rent a car. I'm not taking my car. and then just kind of stay with them. And they're much older now. So, you know, I can go to the talks or whatever. And, you know, if they don't want to join me, they can go do their thing. So it's a lot easier now.
Well, it looks like Con Carolinas is 2 weeks before this year, May 29th to 31st. But anyhow, this year I'm only managing to, I go every year to GAFILC, which is a music convention in Atlanta in early January, and I haven't missed one in 9 years. I'm not going to this year, but the only reason I'm not missing it this year is because one of my close friends decided he was just going to pick up my hotel tab himself, so.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it is. It's sort of like a family reunion. After you've gone to a con 9 years in a row, you know everybody that's going to be there. And if you keep going 9 years in a row, that means that they're happy to see you, or you wouldn't keep going back.
That is true. But I also want to see if I can try to make it out to one of the BSD conventions. I know that last year, or this year rather, 2019, they had a VBSD con, which I wish I had been able to go to that. I know that Rad Alexander, a.k.a. Vulcan Rider, he goes to a lot of those BSD cons. So it'd be nice to actually meet him there on one of those.
Looks like Texas Linux Fest is going to be in Austin this year, so 50-50 on whether or not I can go.
I just looked up SELF, and they still have last year's dates on the website.
Oh, well, I'm going to have to
keep an eye on that. I think there's another site. It's Southeast Linux Fest 2020.
Okay, .org.
Okay.
Hold on. I was just on. I got to get back to it. It's just SoutheastLinuxFest.org. SoutheastLinuxFest.org.
Well, that's where I was, and it says June 14th to 16th, 2019.
Look at the menu at the top.
Self 2020.
Yes.
Aha. Oh, they don't have much information, and it's in tiny type. Yep.
Yeah, they probably won't have anything until, like, March, anything more until March, probably.
Yeah, and the dates there say 12th to the 14th, 2020, so
it's true.
I'm going to have to keep that in mind.
Request for papers closes January 31st. Well, I would love to make it. I tried to make it last year. I may start a fundraiser a little bit earlier this year and see if my listeners are a little more moved. Last year, when my fundraiser failed by about $500, I just split what I got and donated half to Linux Mint and the other half to archive.org. And everyone seemed to be happy with that. So,
hey, Dan, it's been a while since I've been to a self. Have there been any more drunk brides flashing everybody?
No, not since that one year, but it's always talked about.
Yeah, that was legendary. Yeah. See what happens when you hang out with Pat Volkerding?
So you know what's pretty weird about it is the past couple of times I've been to South, there's like only like one or two people that I know that are still that still show up at South, and it's like all new people there that I've never met before. So it's an interesting collection.
Well, in 2019, the entire Destination Linux crew was there, so I wanted to get there for that. Oh, okay.
Who's Destination Linux?
Destination Linux, it's a podcast with, it's actually a video podcast, but they do an audio version as well with Noah Chalaya and Zebedee and Ryan, whatever his name is, and Michael Tunnell. And Michael Tunnell does This Week in Linux, and Noah's got his Ask Noah show, and Zebedee's various gaming video casts that he does. And my mind is blanking on Ryan, but I'm sure I know more. They've actually put together a whole network which has picked up Jason Evangelo's Linux for Everyone podcast. And they started another ancillary podcast, Cubicle Nate and someone else called DLN Extend, where they actually talk about what happened on this Destination Linux podcast or another one on the network.
Is Jason Evangelo the one that writes for Forbes on Linux?
Yep. Yep. Jason Evangelo, he says.
So I have a question about this because I just haven't had time to keep up with so much stuff. But Noah used to be part
on
of...
On Jupiter, yep.
Yeah, on Jupiter. And then he took his show
solo? When they were selling... Well, he started his show, and he sort of kept it separate from Jupiter. And when Jupiter got bought by Linux Academy, Noah was not part of the offer. And he took his show elsewhere and then got involved in the Destination Linux podcast, and they now have the Destination Linux network.
Okay. That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, I do not know any of the internal stuff on why Linux Academy wanted some staff and not others, or some shows and not others. They definitely, before the sale, they closed down Unfilter and Linux Action show, and then they started up new ones, and they're still starting up new ones. And as long as Chris is happy, you know,
isn't that all that matters?
Well, it is to him.
Hey, at least he's still doing what he loves. So, good, bravo, good on him. Good on him.
He's, yeah,
good on him.
And for that matter, Joe. Boy, my brain is not working right now. Ressington is a Linux Academy employee now and does all of the audio editing for almost all their shows.
Oh, good on him. When's the Mintcast going to join Destination Linux?
We're not interested. Now,
you told them no. You said, get out of here.
No, they didn't ask. they asked people that were interested to apply. And I will say DistroHopper's Digest did ask, and we have not yet even been responded to. We do know that Zebedee Boss knows that we had applied because he has been in personal contact with Tony Hughes. But he says, well, you know, some things take a while. And I kind of think it takes a lot less time than it takes to just say, we got your application and we'll think about it. We don't even have that at this point. But I'm more sensitive to these things than Tony Hughes is. He says, just hang on to your hat. We might get there yet. But then again, Distro Hopper's Digest, we're almost up to 500 downloads per episode. We're not a big wheeler and dealer in this neck of the woods.
Are you having fun doing it?
Oh, yeah.
That's all that matters.
Yeah, it was my idea, and Tony Hughes said, yeah, and that's a good thing because I know diddly about audio editing, and Tony does all of that for us. And having only two streams makes it fairly easy for him to do that. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I love just playing around with what comes out. If I can get it to run on my machine, I'll talk about it.
How many episodes are you up to?
We're going to be recording episode 9 on January 8th. We only do one a month, so we give whatever distros we're looking at enough time to really get into them and find out what's good and bad about them, and in some cases, ditch them and have time to put something else in.
This is terrible, and I should just listen to episode 7. But I'm just curious right now, because I was thinking the other day, I was like, man, I remember when Mandrake Linux was like the biggest thing, like, ever.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Mandrake Linux.
Yeah, I started with Mandrake. That was the first one I managed to get running on one of my computers.
Yeah, I was a big Mandrake fan. I was running Red Hat. I don't remember which version. I did 6 or 7 back in the day. And then I switched over to Mandrake.
Well, we have done a review on OpenMandriva 4, which is a community-based version of what was left.
That's episode 7. I'm curious. Like, one of the things I remember from Mandrake, like, one of their big claims of fame was DrakeConf. And they had, like, it was almost similar to, like, what SUSE had with Yast, but it was, like, just, like, is that still in? Do they still have, like...
They, OpenMandriva that? Has just moved to... DNF Dragora.
Okay.
And now the OpenMandriva is sort of based on the Russian professional version called ROSA. The developers who are left from the Mandrake and Mandriva projects are running not Manjaro. It sounds like Manjaro and isn't. My brain is not working again. I almost had it there. Look at my magic box, see if I still have a copy. No, I don't. That didn't help. Darn it. And then there's also PC Linux OS, which broke off from the Mandrake Mandriva project before they went under. So there are currently 4 versions of Mandrake still floating around.
Were you thinking of Magia?
Magia, that's the one. Doesn't that sound like Manjaro to you?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, I was going through my mind, is the M's and just going through distros. So I was like, Magia.
Well, most of the French developers are still working on Magia.
Got it.
And the Russian developers came up with ROSA, and then OpenMandriva was the community getting together and using the ROSA code base to work from.
Well, it's nice to see that at least the spirit of what was Mandrake is still alive. Man, I remember when they used to call it, what was it, Linux Mandrake, and then they'd switch to Mandrake Linux. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's how far back I went with that one.
Yeah. I will say that in my experience, I liked OpenMandriva 3 better than I liked 4. 4 had a lot of improvements in visual stuff, but some of the things seemed to go backwards in how well it worked for my machines that I had at the time.
Got it.
But the problem with 3, well, you got 3.03 is the latest version of 3, and you download it, you install it, and then you've got 3,400 updates to do. And when you're running something like Discover, that's not a fun thing.
That's what happens when you don't update a day or two on Arch, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't know. I don't run Arch. Not a purist.
Yeah, I played with Arch, but that was many. That was maybe, what, 8-10 years ago? And then I kind of switched off from it.
Well, the other group of people that are put down as much as Arch users are Gentoo users. And believe it or not, there are a couple of very easy-to-use Gentoo-based distros out there. One is the Italian Sabayon, and the other is Russian Calculate Linux.
Yeah, I was just as you mentioned Sabayon, I was gonna bring that one up, and I was curious if they were still active.
They just came out with a new version, version 20, just yesterday or day before. I actually put it on one of my machines. I almost got it right. The installer was pretty easy to use and understand, unlike a lot of very in-depth installers, like OpenSUSE. But I still got something wrong, so I went back and I tried it again, and I got something so wrong it messed up my setup. And I literally had to call System 76 and say, hey, how do I reset the BIOS on this? So I don't think I'm going to try a third time on Calculate, but it looked really good. It ran really well. I just somehow didn't get my username included in those who were approved to use sudo, and so that's why I tried it again.
So my question is it as bad or as painful as partitioning when you're installing Fedora?
I would say no, but I have never successfully installed Fedora.
I say that tongue-in-cheek because yeah. I do run Fedora, and yeah, their partitioner, I'm used to their partitioner now, but when it first came out, oh my goodness, it took a bit to wrap my head around it.
I've never gotten through an installation of Fedora. I've tried it a few times. Ditto, I have problems with OpenSUSE. There's just some wording or some way that they do it that does not make sense to me, and I cannot continue. I didn't have that problem with Calculate Linux. I got through the installer two whole times before I messed up my setup, my BIOS.
Well, I'm also waiting for Patrick Volkerding to officially release Slackware 15 so I can put it on something, even though I run Slackware Current on a machine at work.
Do you have an inside tab on that there? Because they haven't released something since, like, what, 2016?
Yeah.
The person to ask might be Klaatu, but I mean he's more on the Slackware than I am nowadays. But yeah, if Current is basically 15, but the idea, the what they always say with regards to Slackware is that it'll be released when it's ready.
Right. Well, you know, look at the other ones; they're usually like 3 years apart too.
Mm-hmm.
Though I've had to actually switch because I used SBO PKG. I've had to actually stop using that because it wouldn't update certain Slack builds. And I switched over to another set of tools called SBO Tools, which is very similar to how package on FreeBSD works. So I've used that and actually has a tree for the for Current. And it seems to update pretty well. I've been happy using that one. And it actually resolves any dependencies. No more need for Q files or anything like that. It actually checks for you what you need. And it builds that before anything else.
Wait, what was that?
SBO Tools.
Oh, SBO Tools. Is that SBO package?
That's what I used to use. But then it just stopped working with Slackware Current.
Okay. And then, so are they just using SBO Tools now?
What's I'm using it.
I mean, what's the difference between SBO package and SBO tools?
Well, I mean, they both build Slack builds, but just in a different way. SBO PKG used Q files, and it actually had like an ncurses interface if you wanted to use that. If you ran it without any switch commands or anything like that, just this SBO PKG itself, it would launch the ncurses interface. SBO Tools is more like PKG on FreeBSD, where you just run it and it has a bunch of other commands. There's no ncurses interface or anything, but it's pretty easy to use. Well, easy for a Slackware user. That's what I'm going to say.
So what I found a little confusing about it is, like, they're both called SBO, the prefix of SBO, and I'm thinking they were related in some way, SBO package and SBO tools, but they're not, are they?
No, they're not. I think the person who created SBO tools is usually on the Freenode Slackware IRC channel, or at least was. I don't know if they're there anymore.
I've been itching to run Slackware for a long time again.
I'm going to try and get the link for SBO tools and put it in the chat.
Is it? It's not the GitHub page, right?
Yeah, pink-miss.github.io. That's the one.
There we go.
Yeah, and I think that user's still on the IRC channel for Slackware on Freenode.
Right, yeah, you could use Slack builds to build SBO tools. All right.
Yeah, there it is. It says it's like ports mm-hmm. on FreeBSD.
Let me inch my way back to Savion, which I kind of wanted to talk about a little bit more.
Go for it.
I really think that you could put a new user on Savion. The install is easy. The main thing you have to do is run your search for mirrors before you do your updates. It will literally save you 2 hours of download time. It takes longer to install than anything else, but it's not building packages. It's just finding them, and it's a whole lot of fun. There's all kinds of cute little things in it that I've not seen in any other distro, and I still have it installed on my little Galago Pro here.
I don't know if any of you remember SoundChaser. Haven't seen him in a while, but he was, from what I remember, he was a fan of Savion, and he used to run that. But we're talking years ago. I don't know now. He's kind of dropped off as well from the interwebs.
You know, doing Distro Hopper's Digest, 9 times out of 10, we finish the review saying, well, it was fun and it worked really well, but I don't think I'm keeping it around anymore. And Savion was one I just couldn't let go of after I was done playing with it. So I'm still playing with it.
Yeah, I used to distro hop so much between Ubuntu and all the other distros that eventually I settled on, I was running Ubuntu for a while, but it was either Ubuntu or Slackware. And then I got into Fedora, which I wasn't a fan of actually up until version 13. And that one kind of convinced me. I was like, okay, this is a little better because the previous version seemed very slow to me. And then it just kept getting better from then on. And so I've been running Fedora for years now. And it's kind of moved to my primary Linux distribution of choice. Of course, I have to add the RPM Fusion repos. Otherwise, you know, I mean, I use it also for gaming. I have Steam on it. I have Minecraft on it when I play with my kids, a bunch of other stuff. I use it for working on music when I have time. So that's pretty much, it has everything. And I think for me, it's got a good balance of the latest and greatest and stability. I used to run Debian, I used to run Ubuntu, I used to switch Debian over to the SID repo. And yeah, it, I mean, it was, there were moments where things broke and, you know, it's what it is. It's unstable. But even then, I mean, it's rather stable for what it is. But I think Fedora gave me a good balance of the, not so much the cutting edge, but near there, which is fun for me.
Well, my closest friend before he passed used to run Fedora all the time, and I just couldn't see it. And then I started listening to the Jupiter shows, and it seemed like every 6 months they were installing Fedora on something and then trashing it later, or they try to do the upgrades and the upgrades don't work. And it just didn't sound that good of a system to me from the way it comes across on the air.
Yeah, I remember them talking about that kind of, about Fedora in that way. I never really listened to them much, but I remember hearing stuff about that. And I was like, oh, I don't know what they're going through. It seems to be working fine for me. The trick for me was to avoid using the graphical updater and just stick to the command line. So when they switched to DNF, I always used yum on the command line. And I just switched over to DNF. On Debian-based distros, I actually used to install Synaptic, which I found was really nice for installing packages.
And, hasn't been maintained for 2 years now. That's the thing I'm afraid of.
Yeah, it's a shame because I think it was good for the power user.
Yeah.
It kind of gave you a nice balance. It was very intuitive, I found it. And in comparison to the other tools that were supposed to be easier for end users, but they tended to be very crashy.
Yeah, well, I've been using Linux on and off since 02, and I'm still the kind of user that would be the guy that just came over from Windows and doesn't know what he's doing. But over the past year plus of doing Mintcast, I have gotten finally somewhat comfortable with some aspects of the command line. And so graphical tools are what I would be using, and if they mess up, then I'd be lost, you know?
Yeah, no, I understand you completely. That's where I was for a while. And then actually I was like that for a good while until I tried Slackware. And from Slackware, really what they say is you want to learn Linux, use Slackware. For me, that's exactly what it was. And actually that helped me jump over to the BSD side. And because since the scripts that it uses are BSD style, the transition wasn't as steep as far as the learning curve. But there is still a learning curve when you go to a BSD and compared when coming from Linux.
There's a learning curve getting through the installer on a BSD. I haven't
done it
yet.
I have to say, I run OpenBSD. It's my favorite of the BSDs. And the installer is very Spartan, but it's very simple. The first time I installed it, I think the only thing I had trouble with was the partitioner, because I think I've used their own FDisk. But once you get a little familiar with that, it's not too bad. Everything else, as far as the installation is concerned, is super easy. It actually surprised me how easily I got it installed.
Well, my main machine, I've got 7 distros on it. I've got another one on my travel machine and another one on my wife's machine. We just play around with things until they work, and every now and again I swap out one of the ones that's on my main machine, get tired of it, or find something else I want to try, and where am I going to put it? And I keep all of my data on an external drive, so I've got the same data available no matter what I'm running. Make sure I've got all the main apps that I use. I'm one of the people that has been screamed at for years and years because you use a proprietary Office package. I'm sorry, OpenOffice / LibreOffice is not good enough for my editorial needs. It just messes up formats.
No. I understand that completely. I've really, my evolution as a free software, open source software user, I've become more pragmatic when it comes to certain things. So I get when people need to run Microsoft Office. I like that there's choice now. I like that they finally support the open document format properly. So in the direction that Microsoft has taken, especially in recent years, it has been good. But yes, cautious optimism on my part. I'm still kind of like, eh. But as far as, you know, if you got to use the tool that works for you, that's where I stand right now. And, you know, if it's free and open source, great. But if it has to be proprietary because there is no viable solution, then so be it. I mean, it's all about choice.
I've been using SoftMaker since 2010, and I was still on Windows. Of course, for Windows users, you can buy it as a shampoo office, which has frequent deep discounts, whereas SoftMaker does not believe in discounts. But the fact that there was a Linux version when I started really getting serious about Linux in 2012 made it that much more something I wanted to use, and I've never had a problem converting documents to and from Microsoft, either spreadsheets or book documents. I spent 2 years as senior editor of a small publishing company, and you have no idea how many documents I had to rescue from people that were trying to use OpenOffice.
Most cases,
we had to completely wipe it back down to a text file and reformat the whole book.
I believe that so long as you don't have to deal with any of the Microsoft Office suite stuff, using LibreOffice actually is not a bad option. I actually knew someone personally that she didn't have Microsoft Office and she needed to do certain lesson plans. And I said, well, you know, she didn't have the money to pay for Microsoft Office. So I said, well, let's give this LibreOffice a try. And, you know, I kind of helped her out and figuring out how to use it. And she actually did pretty well with it. She was doing lesson plans and a whole bunch of other stuff on it. And she used it. She was happy with it. Of course, when she started having to use Microsoft Office at work, the only good thing was that the stuff that she did, since it by default saved as open document text, Office would open it because they were using a more current version of Office. So it supported everything open the way it was supposed to. Maybe there was some little formatting thing, but nothing that big a deal that they couldn't just make a change to, but it was in rare occasion.
Well, I've been using OpenOffice since, well, my first copy was Star Office 5.
I remember Star Office. That was bad. I remember working with that and trying to convince people. I was like, yeah, I was having a hard time convincing myself with Star Office, but it was the only option on Linux at the time.
Yeah, well, I am all for open source. I push open source. But in this case, I worked, like I said, for 2 years as senior editor of a small publishing company, and we were tearing our hair out over some of the format problems that we had converting back and forth from Microsoft to LibreOffice, or I guess it was still OpenOffice then. OpenOffice.org, excuse me. It was horrible, and we had to tell people, do not use OpenOffice. And I reported 3 bugs to them, and they came back to me and said, we are not interested in fixing these bugs. And that turned me off.
That'll turn anybody off. I understand. But if the rumor mills are true, what they say, now that Microsoft's released Teams for Linux, maybe we'll see an Office for Linux finally in 2020.
But see, why do we need Office for Linux? We already have SoftMaker, and it's every bit as good, and it's a lot cheaper.
Well, there you go. Well, I mean, I guess if, I don't know, there's that instance where maybe they need a version of Microsoft Office for Linux, and if it's available, they already have a contract with Microsoft, they can probably throw that in as well. That's the only thing I can think of.
Okay, well, as I said,
it's a possibility.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm going to drop off. I got to start getting ready myself. I'm actually the one that's going to be grilling the New Year's Eve barbecue tonight. So I got to get myself ready and get the food ready. So all of you, I hope if you aren't already in the new year, have a very safe and happy and prosperous new year. And I'll see you next year.
Nice talking to you, Claudio. It's still 1925 here in Eastern Tennessee.
I believe you. Have a good one, everybody.
Bye.
Happy New Year, Claude. Good to hear from you.
And there went Claudio.
Don't say it like that with such finality.
It says Claudio M left channel and disconnected. That sounds pretty final to me.
Oh, no. There's always reconnection.
I guarantee you he will not be back this year.
I never bet against Claudio.
Well, when he said he's heading for the grill to make the food for whoever's celebrating with him, I don't think he's going to come back to a microphone when he's busy with a grill.
Give him about 4.5 hours. I think we'll hear from him again.
Okay.
He usually likes to pop in right at his time change. I don't believe we met. I'm Pokey. How you doing?
Hi, Pokey. I'm Moss. I'm one of the co-hosts of Mintcast and founder and co-host of DistroHopper's Digest.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. I'm not so special myself.
Well, I'm definitely special, but maybe not in the best way.
Significant were the word I was hunting for.
Ah,
so
significant
myself.
I have at least one significant digit. I think it's called a pinky.
Yeah, I'm one of the co-hosts of the Urandom podcast.
I just learned about that, and I just finished adding it to my podcatcher about an hour ago.
Oh, well, then I apologize in advance for any listening you might do.
So it's you and Taj?
And Lyle. It's, frankly, it's more those two guys than me. I'm more of the comic relief. Those two guys are the technical experts.
Yeah, that's what I've been considering myself on Mintcast. I'm sort of the Guy Fliegman of the troop. Yeah.
There's a reference I don't get.
Galaxy Quest?
Yeah, I know Galaxy Quest. Which one was Guy Fliegman?
Rock.
Oh, all right.
But you're not the crew member that gets killed. Maybe you're the plucky comic relief. You think I'm plucky?
Got it.
What was that, Sam Rockwell's role?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not so good with names when it comes to movies.
Me either.
Can't help you much with that. I spent too many years without a television or movie watching or any of that kind of stuff. Kind of starting to get back into it a little now. You know, with like Amazon Prime videos and that kind of thing. But you know, I am not the aficionado that I used to be as far as movies and television goes.
Yeah, well, we're some of those pirates you hear about. I basically pay my internet provider for the cheapest possible TV that gives me fast internet. I don't even plug in their TV box. I open up Kodi and I run one of the plugins and VPN over to Amsterdam and where it's legal, and watch whatever I want to watch, assuming I can find a stream.
Oh yeah, see, for me it's not so much not having the ability, I'm just interested.
Yeah. Well, there are a number of shows that we would like to watch, but we are so bloody poor that we can't afford to pay the hundreds of dollars it would take to have the TV to watch them.
Yeah, I just as soon not watch them and find something else to do. Tough in the winter time though. Usually in the summer I can be found on a motorcycle or in my convertible tooling around, but in the it's a little trickier.
I have neither a motorcycle nor a convertible.
That's a sad state of affairs, my friend.
I have a Chevy Cobalt and a Mazda 2. The Mazda 2 is really fun to drive, I gotta tell you that.
I don't doubt it. I've heard really good things about Mazda lately. They're taking kind of a different track technically, to give their cars a different feel than the mainstream, so I don't doubt that at all.
Well, I got a 2014 that had a bit high mileage on it, but I only had to pay, I think, $5,000 for it. For something that new, that's not bad. And she zooms really nicely. Got a 5-speed stick on it, also known as Millennial Theft Protection.
Yeah, for sure. I got a Mazda myself. My convertible's a Miata.
Ah.
Or an MX-5 for any international listeners.
Not an RX.
No. Those are big money.
Yeah, well.
I got to say, though, the RX-7 is quite possibly my favorite car of all time. Especially the looks of it. The maintenance, maybe not so much, but... You know, it'd be worth it. I'd go through it if I could get.
Well, I think it's amazing what the Japanese engineers did with that Wankel engine anyhow, because the German engineers only could get like 12,000 miles out of a set of seals.
Yeah, it wasn't just them either. There was a Suzuki motorcycle that had the Wankel in it.
Mm-hmm. Whereas the RX-7, you could expect 50,000 miles and you might get lucky up to 70.
I don't know. I've seen plenty of them with more miles than that. They seem to get around 125. That seems to be about the limit of apex seals with with a street porting tune on it. You go for what they call a bridge port, which is more of a racing application, and that's going to drop right down.
Well, I need to go AFK for a couple of minutes. I won't be long. And I'll be back.
It was nice meeting you, Moss.
Nice meeting you, Pokey.
I heard the name Galaxy Quest. That's one of my favorite movies.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's one of all of our favorite movies. It's right up there with Revenge of the Nerds for me.
Yeah, and I recently saw some of the movie review said that the Revenge of the Nerds stuff that was too sexual or sexist or what have you would never fly these days.
It's probably true. It probably would not fly these days.
As a confirmed pedestrian, I love getting these calls. Your extended warranty is expiring. And I call them up and I say, oh, my extended warranty is expiring. Would you thank you very much? And they ask me, what's the make and model of your vehicle? And I said, excuse me, let me know. I don't have one.
No, I haven't even got time for them, but I would tell them New Balance.
Yeah, well, the... No, I just... You know, and of course they say that they're going to take you off the call list, and they never do.
I always just transfer them to Elizabeth Warren, because she's the one who promised to put an end to such calls.
You mean Pocahontas?
Yeah, that's the one. I wasn't going to call her a political nickname. I'm not coming in here to divide the group. That ain't my part.
Don't worry. She's promising to tear down every house that everybody lives in because they're not energy efficient.
Mine could use it, actually.
Well, yes, but with the housing shortage, when you can't build enough houses, something gets a little wrong with this picture.
Something's always a little wrong with the picture when there are politicians involved, my friend.
Well, I am somewhat looking forward to the House elections next year.
All right, I'll bite. Go ahead.
Well, if you want to see what, if you want an example of what's probably going to happen, just remember the British elections of this fall.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. I'm not making any predictions myself. I know what my own views are, and I think I've been fairly outspoken on those throughout the years. But, you know, like I said, I'm not one to come into the HPR chat room and be divisive. I think division is the weapon of the politicians, and they are the enemy, not the rest of us, the enemy to one another.
I'll agree heartily. Just that whenever I see the Democratic maneuvers, totally impartial, of course, it reminds me of an old adage, never interfere with an enemy going making a major mistake.
I'm not sure I get the reference, but yeah, as far as the Democrats go, I don't think the Republicans are any better or any worse. I think Ron Paul said it best when they asked him what he thought of a third party, and he said, I'd like to see two first.
Well, I think that's the one thing that Trump has brought, is he has jumped the fence so far that politicians on both sides are having problems with their cookies.
So your name in here is Netminer. What exactly do you mine the net for, sir?
Well, my grandfather was a coal miner, and I mine the net for military history, technology, computers, modern and ancient. I'd actually like to run a nice small 370 or the 380 when they get the project up, which is a completely open source reimagining of the 370 XX or 30 whatever architecture.
I'm not familiar. Are you talking about older computers, mid 1900s or so?
Yeah, well, 370 was a 70s era machine. They're IBM machines when IBM was big.
Do you watch YouTube much?
Yeah, probably more than I should, but I watch a lot of that. There's actually a IBM computer emulator that is amazing. It even runs 3090 Linux. That is to say, it will run big disks, big Linux, everything on top of Linux or Windows.
Sounds cool. Have you seen the History Guy yet? He's fairly new on YouTube.
Oh yeah, I see a lot of his stuff. I cover some of the gaming. Another channel is Outdoors with the Morgans and some of the others. I follow some farming channels, again, trying to connect with my roots. And and the places where I had sanity of growing up.
You mean to say you have your roots in roots?
Actually, I remember looking forward to smelling the smells of home, including cow manure.
Oh, but that's ranching. I thought you said farming.
Dairy farming.
Aha. Okay. Then my joke is not even a decent joke.
And actually, I had the good fortune of being exposed to both milk can farming, dairying, that is, with an individual milking machine and a single container, etc., and bulk dairy farming, which is a primitive ancestor to the current technology when milk was picked up by things that looked like shiny oil trucks and was handled in a rather modern way. This was back in the 60s.
If it makes you feel any better, Moss, I got roots in roots right now.
You're changing your name to Alex Haley, I take it.
No. My daughter sent me a shiitake mushroom growing kit for Christmas. They, of course, have their roots in roots.
Hey, well, is that actually roots? That's a different thing. But okay.
Psyllium, it's close enough.
Yeah, one of the guys I follow is down in New Jersey. You know, he calls himself One Lonely Farmer. He bales a lot of big bales, 1,500-pound bales, for the Pennsylvania mushroom growers. They use it as a substrate for their growing mushrooms under, you know, in their caverns or whatever.
Yeah, there's a couple of places here in the Knoxville area that deal with mushroom mulch and I'd say seedlings, but that's not the right word. Mushrooms are a big business here.
What I find interesting, not only is the bales, not the man portable ones that I remember, but because the mushroom stuff is grown on moist hay and rotting hay, the treatment of hay and it preserving its quality is completely different.
Well, sadly, I grew up a city boy, and my parents both had their farming childhoods, but they did not allow me to have one. And so I hear about all this stuff and don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, what I ran into was my father, shortly after World War II, turned 80 or 90 acres of weeds into a humming, comparatively modern dairy operation. Now, it's very hard to farm on 0.8 acres in a metropolitan area. So it would be very hard for me to make it the kind of accomplishments that he made on a farm. And therefore, also because of some coordination issues and whatnot, I wasn't the kind of son that he would have raised in West Virginia.
I very definitely did not want to be growing up in Los Angeles, but I had no say in the matter.
Well, likewise, but also it was a little difficult since my father didn't notice the difference between Boston and rural West Virginia or Maine.
Yeah, I wanted out of L.A. so bad that I had my parents send me to college in Sterling, Kansas. Most people didn't even know there was a Sterling, Kansas, let alone a college there.
Well, I went through college at home, but I also ran into a problem with the education system. I was a B student until I got to junior high, and then I became an A student in anything that I actually applied myself to moderately. I didn't get smarter. However, I adapted to the just-in-time education system. They would tell you what was going to be on an exam. You could preload your head. you would take the exam, offload the information that they requested, move on to the next subject or exam.
My brain refused to work like that, and as such, I never actually found a field I could be in, and as such, I never finished college, but I at least got sent away from Los Angeles for a few years and stayed away.
Well, if I'd gone to community college, I probably could have gotten a degree, but when I hit real college, my lack of cumulative knowledge and study habits, and the fact that the college started me over behind where I had been when I left high school. I took an extra postgraduate year, so I, of courses that I wouldn't dare take while they counted. I crashed and burned after a couple of years. Of course, my dad was a nasty drunk, and I was going into school early in the morning and leaving as late as possible and to get public transportation to my parents' home.
Well, I think I'm going to take off. I'm sure my wife wants to see something on the tube, and I might myself. I don't think I've even watched my usual CBC News broadcast.
Well,
come back on later, Moss.
I kind of doubt it. I think I'm going to be busy, and I have to get up early in the morning to talk with Tony. We've got a meeting for Distro Hoppers, and then I have to go to work at 9.
Great.
Well, it was good talking to you.
See you, Joe. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for everything.
Sure. Talk to you soon, Netminer. Or I don't know if I'll talk to you soon. I know I'll talk to Joe soon because he's on Mintcast with me. All right. See you guys. Happy New Year.
Take it easy. Taj, how you doing, man?
Pretty good, man. Just ate some dinner with some friends, got my belly full of like awesome Korean food, and now I'm ready to just like chat. Let's do this.
Are you reading that book we discussed last time?
I have not started yet. I've talked a lot, but I haven't talked to you. Drama abounds right now.
Gogi, Kogogi. Yeah.
Hi, Joe.
Hey, Kimchi.
I'm sorry, what's that?
Oh, we were talking about Korean food, and I'm wondering what you had.
I had some bulgogi, and my wife had some bibimbap, which is my favorite thing to say.
I love bulgogi.
It is quite amazing.
There's a couple of good bulgogi places in the Dallas area. I've yet to find anything in the El Paso area.
Yeah, we've got this one that opened a couple of years ago in town. It's like it's a Korean place. That does it also has like a ramen counter where you can get like ramen if you want it. But the funny thing is the people there are Chinese. They speak Mandarin, so it's kind of fun for me.
Well, you know, Korea is like right there in the middle between Japan and China, so I guess it's not all that surprising.
I don't care. Everything they make is delicious. So
as long as the food's good.
It is. It's very good. So Pokey, that picture you sent on Signal, is that your mushroom log?
Yes, that was my mushroom log.
Okay, I was hoping so. Either that or something went horribly wrong.
No, that's the way it's supposed to look as far as I can tell. It doesn't look like that anymore, though. I harvested all of them off it today. I'm going to try to start again in 2 days and see if I can get a second batch out of there.
Mushrooms are one of the things that, like, I want to learn more about, and I want to learn how to grow them because they're just, like, fascinating. I just hate mushrooms, so it's like
right?
I would be giving them away to everybody, but I don't really know that many people who like them, so...
That's exactly what I did with these. I do not like shiitake mushrooms at all. I really like mushrooms. I like most mushrooms I've ever tried. I really do not like shiitake mushrooms. And I don't really care for portobello. I'll eat them, but I don't really care for my favorite are just the white button mushrooms. Those are my favorite common ones. I've had others that are really terrific, but that's about it.
I hear all these stories of people who are like, oh, you just haven't tried the right mushroom. Or, oh, they haven't been prepared correctly. And nobody is willing to like actually do the magic thing that they need to do and let me try it. So I guess I just live in ignorance.
I don't know what to tell you because I do them wrong all the time and I still love them. So I guess I just like mushrooms.
Fair enough. I wish I did. They're really good for you.
Yeah, I've run across occasionally, usually not early enough to harvest, are the puffball mushrooms.
Oh, I've never harvested wild mushrooms. That's a little too scary for me.
I've got a friend who's really into it. And he's a scientist during the day. So like I think he actually knows what he's talking about, like the different species and stuff. But I've never gone with him when he does it. Like he'll go out on like 3-day trips just to go tromp through the forest and find different kinds of mushrooms.
I'd love to learn if there was, you know, somebody near me that did that. I'd love to go with them because I see mushrooms out in the forest all the time. And like, I don't even want to touch them because I know some of them are so deadly or at least are so unhealthy. Like, I don't even go near them.
It's like either it's going to taste terrible or I'm going to be tripping balls or I'm going to die. None of these sound fun. So I'm just going to take a pass.
Or it could be really, really delicious if you saute it with butter.
There's not a whole lot in the world that doesn't taste delicious when you saute it with butter. Mushrooms is kind of the exception to that rule.
I don't know. There's some crazy ones out there. I my favorite, if you ever see them, you might want to try them just because they're unique. But lobster mushrooms are just out of this world.
See, that's one of the ones that I keep hearing about that everybody's like, oh, yeah, you just need to try that. I can't find them. Like, nobody has them.
No, they're really hard to find. I can only get them at, like, a special grocery store up here.
I need a special grocery store.
Oh, no, you don't, because you can't afford anything in there. You just buy a little bit of lobster mushroom every now and again.
Lobster mushroom, and then there was, I think the other one was, like, lion something or something like that, and somebody said that one's really good, too.
Lion's mane. I think
yeah,
I
that's had it.
That and don't remember it. Maybe I didn't have it. If I did, it didn't stick out in my mind. The taste didn't anyway. Anyway, the reason I asked about that book is if you do read it, you got to let me know because it'd be embarrassing if you read it and I don't.
Which book?
Human Action by Ludwig von Mises.
It is on, like I had planned to start it this week, but I just, too much was going on. I didn't have time to start anything. So maybe this week I will get to read a little bit of it. But yeah, I am fully on board for reading the whole thing because I'm just, I need to see that perspective. It's a big gaping hole in my knowledge.
Yeah, I kind of figured when you said there was much drama going on. I wasn't going to ask, but I got it.
It's just some family stuff that doesn't really involve me other than being geographically close to it. Therefore, I have to handle all of it. So, or, you know, the few of us that are geographically close have to handle all of it. So it's just time consuming more than anything else.
Did you have a chance to watch that latest Star Wars movie?
I did.
Okay, just checking. We got to schedule our show at some point.
I have all the thoughts about it.
I had a bunch of thoughts right away, right after seeing it, but they're fading quickly.
My daughter wants to see it, so I'm probably going to go see it again here in the next couple days.
So I don't know if you've seen any of my messages lately to you two guys, but did you see that my motherboard
Yeah, I saw. Well, I saw them stacking up and I was just like, couldn't deal with it. And then I looked at it yesterday and I was like, this goes from like the highest of elation down to just like tragedy at the end.
No, it's not super no, actually those are two different computers.
Oh, okay. I didn't get that. I thought it was the same one.
No, I've you know, as we've talked about, I've got this love affair now with these old HP Elite books, just because they're so rugged, they're so physically sturdy, and they're modern enough processors that they really seem fast to me. So the 15-inch is the second gen. That's the one that I replaced the processor on. I swapped it out for the i7 processor, but there is almost zero advantage to doing so. The i5 in there was so high spec compared to the i7. I don't know why it was not considered an i7, that particular i5.
i5?
It was a first gen i5, I want to say 580M maybe, and the i7 is a 640M, or maybe the 520, I forget now. It's out, but it's the i7 compared to that i5 has like 1.3 or 133 megahertz more, and it has one more megabyte of L3 cache, and it's got the name, and that's it. There is no further benefit to swapping that chip.
Well, the HP Elite books thing.
I'm sorry, you got to key up a little bit longer before you start talking. I missed what you said in the middle.
Okay, so the HP Elite books, is that what you were saying?
Yeah, those are them.
Have you ever checked out the Dell Venue 11 Pro 7130? Or the 7140?
No, I haven't. What's are they like mil spec books?
No, actually they're tablet convertibles, but they are rather heavy duty just because of, I guess, when they were made and how the keyboard is. They do feel very solid, and they are somewhat thicker than most of your tablets. And the 7130 has an i5 processor, and the 7140 has a comparable Core M processor. Well, you can also get the i3 version with the 7130.
Yeah, see, these are the two that I bought, both came with i5s, and they're both socketed motherboards, so there's potential there. I got a 15-inch that's a second-gen EliteBook, and I've got a 12-inch that's a fourth-gen, and that one's got huge potential. That one, people turn that into like a desktop replacement with external graphics cards and everything. I'm not going to do that. I got no interest because I don't game, but it'd be nice to have a real powerful ultra-portable like that. Even though the thing's like 7 years old, it is still just wicked fast.
Which version is that one? The HP EliteBook fourth gen?
The model is the 2570P.
Okay.
There's a very good Wikipedia page on all the EliteBooks. You can kind of see their specs, and most of them, to my knowledge, the 11-inch is the only one that does not have a socketed processor.
No, I keep an eye out because I have teenagers that need laptops for high school.
The 11-inch, I'll tell you, I bought the 11-inch for my buddy, and I bought the 12-inch for me, and the 12-inch is giant in comparison. That inch makes such a difference. And even though it's not socketed, you can still get it with an i5 or an i7, but they're the U spec chips, the ultra low power chips. And it's the i7 is the one my buddy wound up with. Even though we ordered an i5, they sent us an i7, and it is really fast. It is a really, really fast notebook with Linux Mint on it. And it is rugged. It is really, really nice hardware. I mean, they're literally mil spec notebooks. The whole EliteBook series is mil spec.
Well, I'm looking on eBay, and I guess I can order one for $60. I guess I'd have to put in a hard drive myself, though.
Yeah, that's the thing. I spent a little bit more time waiting and looking for one that was complete for myself. And you know, I wound up getting it for $80 after shipping for the 12-inch notebook. They seem to run about 100 to 170. They were all over the place. The i7s seem to be closer to the 150, 170 range. And anything under that seems to have no RAM, no caddy for the hard drive, no battery, no hard drive, no
adapter.
OS. Yeah, no adapter.
I'm not worried about the AC adapter, though, because I used to have an HP EliteBook, one of my old jobs, and I know I had extra power bricks.
Oh, yeah, they're the same. I wouldn't worry about the power brick because they're the same as they've been up until recently. They went to the smaller plug, but they've all been the same. As long as it's a 65-watt plug or more, they all seem to like that one. And I wouldn't worry about the battery because those are about $20 on for aftermarket ones or used. They seem to be about the same price. And the hard drive caddies and the adapters and like the DVD drives or the block off plates, all that stuff seems to come from China. So you can be waiting for it for a while. So my plan was to get one that was complete, and that was a good plan. It powered up like three times, and then the motherboard died, and I can't put the timeline together to figure out what might have killed it, or if it just was, you know, random chance that it died on me, which is sort of what I think happened. But it may also, there's the potential that it was a bad stick of RAM that caused it. But I
internet port and a modem slot in the side of that laptop.
Say that again, I'm sorry.
That's an Ethernet port and a modem in the side of that laptop.
Yeah, which one are you looking at?
Oh, this is the HP EliteBook 2570P.
Oh, yeah, okay, so the one that I got. Yeah, it's actually kind of short on ports compared to the other EliteBooks. My older one, the 8540, has a million ports all over. I mean, I think it's got 7 USB ports, and 2 of them are USB 3.0. It's got separate headphone and microphone jacks, which I like. That thing's loaded. The EliteBook has got quite a few less, but if you need them, you can get a docking station that's got a lot more ports on it. Yeah, it's got everything. These things have like smart card readers built into them. The I forget what the hell the port's called, but people plug into eSATA with it. It's like a 5 gigabit port.
Yeah, no, it's actually an eSATA port.
The 12-inch book has an mSATA connection inside that's not connected. You can solder in, I guess, a couple of small resistors and enable the mSATA as a storage drive, but not as a boot drive. And I guess a lot of people have done that. And it's the port that's there is meant for a WAN card, like a cell card. But you know, if you don't use that, you can solder in a tiny, tiny resistor. You got to be damn good with a soldering iron. But you put in two of those, and you can have mSATA on the inside. Plus, it's got SATA 3 connections for the hard drive and for the DVD drive. So a lot of people will just take out the DVD drive and put in, you know, a couple of solid state drives and go with like a RAID 0, because it's built right into the BIOS that you can do RAID 0.
Yeah, I don't leave CD DVD drives in any of my laptops. The laptop, if it has it, I put in a caddy and put in an SSD.
Dell lets you put a battery in there, but I haven't been able to find a battery for the HP. Not that I really need it. If I use this thing away from home, it's going to be in a scenario where I'd like to have the DVD drive anyway, or at least a CD drive. But yeah, I think they're very nice notebooks. We bought my buddy's 11-inch laptop on Newegg, and it was refurbed, which is nice because then it comes as a complete running machine with all the parts you need, and it's got a warranty. You know, I mean, I figure if it gets through the first week, it's going to get through the next couple of years all right.
Oh, yeah.
And that one, and the other thing to look out for if you're buying them used is, because these were more often than not corporate machines, a lot of times the BIOS is password locked, and to the best of my knowledge, there is no way to unlock it.
You can remove the CMOS, can't you?
You can, and you can solder one in that's unlocked. I've seen those for sale on eBay too, but I mean, that's kind of sketchy business. But then again, these things are so old now for the price of them, it's worth experimenting with if you're into it.
Yeah, so you're a Linux Mint fan?
I'm a Linux Mint user.
But not a fan?
Off and on. I mean, I have a buddy who I convinced him to run Linux, and at the time, Linux Mint was going to be the easiest one to get him to use. And, you know, he's got questions for me often enough that I need to stay familiar with it. So it's just easier to run it than it is to, you know, dual boot or fire up a second laptop to see what he's talking about. So yeah, I kind of run it for that reason.
Cool.
My favorite distro I've ever run was Salix, but I haven't run it in so long. I'm not even sure if it's being maintained anymore.
I haven't heard anything about it.
Oh. But Salix is mostly just, you know, Slackware made easy, but you know, it'd be worth it. At this point, if I didn't have to run Mint, I would probably just run Slackware and figure out how it worked and learn how it worked, because I loved it so much on Salix. The only difference between Salix and Slackware is that Salix comes with a package manager and repositories of, you know, compiled software.
So every time you talk, Pokey, you say Salix, but I hear Arch. I don't know what that's about.
That's a weird thing, because honestly, I couldn't think of two distros that are further opposite on the spectrum than Arch and Slackware.
I don't know. If you're going with like a package manager and pre-compiled things, isn't Slackware pretty much Arch? I mean, you're kind of getting rid of what makes it Slackware.
Not really. You're getting rid of one of the things that makes it Slackware. I agree with you, which kind of makes it Debian at that point. What I like about Slackware, what I liked about running Salix so much, is just how stable it was, how smooth everything ran. It was predictable. Things didn't just change on you because somebody felt like revving something and now your whole UI is different, or just the piece of the UI that you need right now is different. That kind of thing.
I mean, that is totally Arch.
You're not talking about Arch Linux then. I'm not sure what you're talking about, like the St. Louis Arch doesn't change much.
No, I meant the fact that it does change all the time and things change out from underneath you. That is Arch.
Yeah, I know. And that's what I really don't like. That's the thing I don't like about Mint.
But that it changes?
Yeah, that they just change it out from under you, that you get no warning. And I can handle it. My buddy has a harder time with it. And, you know, it's very frustrating to him. And every time it happens, he equates it to Windows, you know, not giving you the choice to stay with what you want or to have to change, which I don't think is a fair comparison, but, you know, I can't really talk him out of it.
No, I've never really noticed Mint changing out from under me.
Really?
Yeah, and I've been using it every day for years.
You didn't notice that the update manager no longer gives you the number for the update levels there, like the risk assessment on the updates?
That's the problem. I don't use the update manager.
Okay.
Just go apt update, sudo apt upgrade.
Yeah, that's one way to do it. But I always figured if Mint was meant to work that way, they wouldn't give you that specific update tool.
Maybe, like using command line.
Yeah, so do I. I'll use the command line on a Debian system. I do prefer it. But if I'm running Mint, you know, I figure there's specific reasons why they thought to break those things out. And they've been doing it that way forever. And then all of a sudden, the 19.3, I think, update it was, they just took that away. You no longer have those levels.
That, I guess, 19.3 hasn't been around long enough for me to actually go look, because I will use the upgrade manager to, when they come out with a new version update and I have to update all of Mint, I will use it then.
Sorry, I meant 19.2, which is a year old now. 19.3 is the new one. I have not checked that out yet either. Plus, in 19.2, they added the, I don't know, snapshots, for lack of a better word. I forget what they call it. That was new. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, though. Like, that's new. They just, you know, that was a change for him that he was like, what the hell is this?
Time shift.
I don't know how to answer this question. Other than that, it has stayed. Oh, and then a couple of times when we've reinstalled, they've changed out the icon sets that it ships with. So we had to go download. We had to figure out what the icon set was that he was using previously and download that again. And some of the icon sets have nothing to do with the GUI, or the desktop environment anyway. Some of them are icon sets that are used within like LibreOffice and that kind of thing. And it just, you know, it's just a change, and it's was a little harder for him to adjust to. Like, I never look at that stuff. I'm fine with it, but he gets so used to using the thing, and he gets so used to the way it works. And, you know, the computer's become his primary means of communication these days. So it's, and the situation he's in, it's really critical that he can use it efficiently. So, you know,
With the update manager, can't you set it just to do the security updates?
Not anymore. Not in any way that I've seen. Plus, it seems to run better if every couple of years you do a fresh install. I mean, like anything would.
I guess I did take that option away to set the level of updates that you're doing.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That was kind of a big change. That was one that he was used to and he relied on. Now I get, you know, an email every other day. Hey, is this one safe to install? Was this one safe to install? And I can't just tell him that, yes, all of them are safe to install, because it was maybe 3 weeks ago that they shipped a kernel that broke his touchpad driver.
What, 5.3? 5.4?
I think it was 4.15 something something 72.
I thought 4.15 was pretty stable. I know that there have been issues with 5.3, why I haven't gone past 5.0, but I didn't know that there was any recent issues in the 4.15 line.
Yeah, it was just whatever one ended in 72, it broke the touchpad drivers in his it might be a Dell.
I need to adjust the sensitivity on my mic. Not always coming up.
Oh man, we're 20 minutes past the Happy New Year. We talked right through it.
Happy New Year. That should do it better. It should pick up me talking now.
Oh, what do you have it set to automatically pick up the Vox activated?
Yeah, but I use a combination. I have a hotkey to mute my mic, and then I'll just leave it as voice activity the rest of the time. Use my hands free to do other things. I guess it helps when I hit apply.
Yeah, you can tell Mumble was originally written for Windows, huh?
Yep. Yeah, but we kind of found out that having a hotkey is great, except most people's hotkey is at right control, and you're using a web page for your show notes, it can have effects when you're trying to scroll through and talk at the same time.
Yeah, it's best to use a key combination of you know, two or more keys.
Yeah, that's what my hot mute is two keys, unless I have my other keyboard, which has a bunch of the Japanese keys on it extra. So that one, it's a one key combo.
Chef Taj print you a foot pedal.
I could do that.
I actually have my stepmother was a transcriptionist, and she has a foot pedal. I just haven't hooked it up to a Linux system to see how it keys in.
I don't know that I could survive with a keyboard that didn't have Hyper and Meh.
What's that?
So a lot of custom keyboards have these two, and I think Hyper is Control Alt Shift, and Meh is like Control Alt Window. And so basically, my keyboard has layers, but then it's like I can make shortcuts with those two, and it's like tripling the amount of keys I have on the keyboard.
Right.
I don't know if those foot pedals work under Linux. I tried looking into those for some transcription work years ago, and there were none that I could find that would work with Linux at all without some. I think there was one that somebody was able to map something to, but it was a weird hack.
Yeah, I mean, well, if it sees it as a keyboard and it presses, then it should come up as something, and you should be able to do something with it there. But I don't know yet because I haven't hooked it up.
No, well, unless it's newer. At the time, they didn't even show up as an HID. They needed their own specific driver, and then you had to map something somehow.
Yeah.
I know the one that Lyle has, I think he used UDEV to like get it to talk to the computer and to assign the key to it, but the pedal itself was junk. You can take an old pedal and just rip out everything but the switch in it and just wire in like a Arduino micro and just program it to be a HID controller.
Hmm.
Yeah, then wire it to like a guitar pedal so you feel all rock and roll. And it's rugged. And you
well, you can probably also order one of those giant big red buttons.
Yes.
And just stomp on that thing every now and again.
Not so rugged, I would guess, but yeah.
Well, they've got the padded enter buttons. They're a giant enter button, but they're almost a pillow. Use that.
Not familiar with that one. That like the one that opens the door for you at the library, that enter button?
No. Hold on. Let me see if I can find it, and I'll drop a link.
I should make like a little stuffed something that has a switch in it to give to Lyle that whenever you squeeze it, it just closes them.
And I guess you could remap this as a separate keyboard and have it be whatever you wanted.
That's actually funny. I also love that it has a pull down for the color, and it just comes in black. That's the only color.
Yeah.
Like a Model T that way. Oh, yeah, also attached. I didn't want you to feel too heartbroken about the dead motherboard because I was able to get a replacement for like $20.
Hey, that's a win.
Yeah, like I said, these things are so old now that you can hack on them for very cheap money.
Yeah, I'm just now getting with my Lenovo to where not like everyday things work great, but if I'm doing any video or audio stuff, it just like wants to die.
Was it always like that, or is it just getting like that now?
It's just getting like that now.
How old is the thing?
It's probably close to 8 years old.
I would strongly suggest, after all the reading I've been doing and seeing how easy it is, actually, if you take the time to do it right, I would strongly suggest just take it apart, clean the fan and radiator, and replace the thermal paste.
That's not a bad idea. I had not even thought to do that.
In fact, I was thinking that most of the advantages that I've seen in the tests, the benchmarks that I sent to you and Lyle, most of that probably has more to do with the new thermal paste than with the change in processor.
Could be. And since it's a Lenovo, it's like stupid easy to take apart. So that may be my project tomorrow.
I went looking on Tom's Hardware, and they had some thermal paste ratings. And, you know, they had a bunch of different charts that they had made. I want to say they had about 30 different kind of thermal pastes. And I just cross-referenced the one for the low-pressure heat spreader because the laptop's, like, held down with springs, so it's not real high pressure. I cross-referenced that chart with the easy-to-use chart. And the best one I came up with, you know, for both of those was... what the hell? I think it's called Thermal Grizzly. Let me double check. Yeah, Cryonaut Thermal Grizzly. It wasn't too bad. It seems to want to stick to the plastic spatula that it comes with more than it wants to stick to the processor. So probably be better off using the dab technique than the spread technique.
This is how you know that Pokey and I do a show together too often. I literally almost keyed up and said, hey, drop that in the show notes.
You can still drop that in the show notes.
Yeah, well, he meant the other show. We used a different page for it, but yeah, find you a link.
Thanks, Pokey.
If you could drop that in this show notes, that would be great. Or in the Mumble.
Yeah, of course I will. Hang on 1 second. We're not using our other show notes here. That would be very rude.
I don't know. I think at the end of the day, as long as Honky Moo gets the notes, I think he'd be happy.
Yeah.
Here's their official page that really doesn't tell you much. And there'd be the Amazon link. And I'll see. I'm not sure if I can find the, I'll look for the Tom's Hardware page. I might be able to find that again.
Now I just got to figure out what time it is, UTC.
1:30, isn't it?
1:30.
Because I'm pretty sure I'm minus five.
It is indeed 1:30.
Oh, it's 85 products. Yeah, I found it.
Seems a little high for thermal compound.
I mean, I was just going to spread some mayo on it and call it good, but you know.
Well, they have done tests with mayo and ketchup and mustard. And they work. For a short time.
Yeah, they actually did that in this Tom's Hardware test. Mayo and mustard. What did they use? They used toothpaste and denture cream.
I bet denture cream would work pretty well.
No, it really didn't.
I wasn't planning on testing it myself, so.
It looks like it worked a hell of a lot better than toothpaste.
But it doesn't smell minty fresh when it like is really chugging on something.
No, probably not. All the best ones, as far as performance, were all liquid metal. They were all rated as hardest to use correctly as well, and they're kind of scary.
39 products get tested. Make sure this is the same one that you're talking about. Oh, yes, it is. I see you already posted. Oh, no, 85 products.
Yeah, it looks like the one you posted was 2013, and this was 2017.
I'm just looking for the list of the comparison.
There are several lists. They break it up into which ones perform better under high pressure and low pressure, and they had another chart for ease of use, which was pretty much an inversion from all the other charts.
The strip method. It's all about the sausage.
Yeah, I guess that depends on the shape of the chip.
I was just reading off one of the headlines.
Oh, I got you. No, I'm kind of a novice at it, so I spread it out with the applicator that it came with, because there were, I think Arctic Silver had very explicit directions on how to apply their stuff, and then Thermal Grizzly came with an applicator, so I figured I'd do what the Arctic Silver said to do.
We usually just bust out an old credit card and spread it around with that.
That would probably work better than the applicator, because the applicator is like textured, and I think that's what was making it stick to it. And it would really just roll up on the applicator and slide right off the chip. I probably wound up putting on too much.
Oh, that only gets to be a problem when you're trying to take it off again.
Even then, the newer ones shouldn't matter as much. It's been a long, long time since I've had a cooler, you know, weld itself to a chip or glue itself to a chip.
Yes, it's just been a really long time since I put together a computer.
Oh, yeah. These new ones shouldn't do that at all. Like these Elite Books, they come right apart, and you don't even have the option of twisting the heatsink out. You just have to lift it straight up. You don't even have another. I mean, it just comes right out.
Cool.
Yeah, when applying too much makes a difference is when you're using the new metallic ones, because they're conductive and you don't want them to hit any of the little components that are, you know, next to the chip.
Now, this is completely the opposite end of the spectrum when it comes to price, but it sounds very similar to the modularity that you get with the Alienware Area 51M.
No, that's at the same end of the price spectrum. These are just cheap because they're old.
Right.
Like that 11-inch book that I bought my buddy for $160. Mm-hmm. I looked up a review of that. When it was new, it was around $2,000.
Yeah. Okay. That would be the same end of the spectrum. Different age.
Yeah. Like I said, the thing that I like about the Elite Books is just that they're so rugged. They're all metal construction. You know, they're mil spec build. So they're meant to be able to take abuse. Not that I intend on abusing it. I'm actually very kind to my hardware, but it can take it in the case of an accident, you know?
Yeah.
And then I also watched several YouTube videos, you know, building up the courage to take the heatsink off and reapply the stuff. And, you know, all the laptops, you know, all the different laptops that I saw there, it was the same thing for them. They just kind of lifted off and they weren't a problem. The stuff that squeezes out from between the chip and the heatsink that builds up on the side, that does seem to harden up. It was quite a bit more difficult to remove that than it was to remove the other stuff, but it still wasn't glue, thankfully. But yeah, Taj, I'd be willing to bet that your processor's just throttling back because of heat dissipation.
Yeah. And it's always interesting to have a laptop that you can take fully apart and put back together and replace parts on.
Yeah, even if it's not practical, it's at least interesting.
Yeah.
Why I bought the 12-inch book. I didn't need it. I just thought it'd be fun to mess with.
Yeah, the thing I've been tempted to do is to throw an SSD in it because this literally still has spinning rust in it.
Yeah, my SSD is on the way from Amazon. Should be here tomorrow or the day after. Maybe they don't deliver tomorrow. Just going to have a hard time deciding which notebook to throw it into.
I mean, I could make it easy and just say mine.
How good do you think my arm is?
I mean... Come on. Good enough to go to UPS and send it to me?
Oh, you'd be getting something in the mail for sure, but it ain't that.
Because I know how much you love UPS.
Yeah, they're that too. No, I actually got some stuff on the way that I intend to send to you. It's just taken a very, very long time to get here.
That's intimidating.
Now, if it was anything to worry about, I would have sent it straight to your house and had nothing to do with it. Bought it off like a drugstore temporary credit card, you know?
Well, I'm going through the list of things you've sent to me. Fabric for an awesome hammock, a shower phone, and a box of meat. So I'm not worried anymore.
Why does one need a shower phone?
Because you can.
Okay.
That's where almost all of my YouTube happens. Not the ones I post, just the ones I watch. I actually used some of that fabric the day before yesterday, Tosh.
That's awesome.
Taught my niece how to sew with a needle and thread, my little six-year-old niece.
Oh, that's cool.
It really easy because of the lines that are in it. You can see where the stitch has to be. So what I wound up doing, because even that was kind of hard for her as a six-year-old and figuring it out, I just took a Sharpie and drew dots on all the intersections and like halfway through on the other side, halfway between the intersections on the other side of the fabric. So you know, she got a stitch about half the distance between the intersections there. It was real easy for her. She made a little pillow.
I think you've just unlocked the new pedagogy for teaching kids how to sew.
Hey, man, I ain't no pedagogue. I want you to take that back.
I denounce myself and I rescind my previous comments.
All right, I'm going to have to Google that tomorrow.
All right, looks like I'm getting called to supper, so I'll talk to you guys later.
Have a good one, Joe.
Yep. Later, man.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year if we don't hear from you.
And then there were two.
Does that work?
No.
Ah, damn it. Yeah, it was funny because I just basically gave her the needle, you know, and told her make sure she don't poke herself in the fingers and, you know, don't let the loop tie itself in a knot. And I just kept flipping the thing over in my hands for her so she could see the dot on the opposite side.
Yeah.
Yeah, it worked pretty good. I forgot to tell her not to stick me in the finger.
I was wondering why you even told her, because that's one of those like self-correcting problems. You do it like two or three times and you're like, you know what, this sucks, I'm not gonna do this anymore.
And you know, that's totally my mindset too, except when I'm working with the kid, I didn't want her to stick herself in the finger. It's amazing how much you care for them face to face.
Clearly you don't work with kids all day.
No, not all day.
I love the kids. It's a little different. The kids I deal with are like 16 through 18, so they should know better by now.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of them and they're not family.
That's true.
You know, this is my little niece and we got a pretty good relationship, and I don't want to ruin that by her sticking needles in her fingers and going home and telling her parents, "Uncle stuck needles in me."
Remember the Christmas of 2019? So we like to call it Bloody Finger Christmas.
I felt bad for the kid because she was so proud of this little pillow that she made. And when I say little, I mean it was probably 3 inches by 3 inches. It was not a pillow a human would want to rest their head on. She's so proud of it, and she did not want to take it home because I couldn't even convince her. I tried talking her into it. And finally, she admitted to me she didn't want to bring it home because she knew that her dog would eat it.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, and I think she's probably right. Her dogs are kind of out of control. So I thought of another project that she could do next time if she still has interest that her dogs won't eat. I think we could just make a pillowcase for a regular size pillow.
Oh yeah, that would work.
Yeah, especially with that stuff, the ultralight stuff.
Yeah, for sure. It's kind of comfy, I'm not gonna lie.
It is super comfy. It's what my hammock is made of. It feels like satin. It's really nice.
I still need to like actually go string it up in a tree and use it.
Oh, but you made it then?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. You got to get some Dyneema to string it up with.
Dyneema?
Oh yeah, Dyneema is hot shit. It's a Amsteel is a brand. Dyneema is a material. It's really like incredibly high tensile strength per diameter. It's like picture paracord. It's a little bit thinner than paracord, and it's about three times the breaking strength.
Yeah, I'm sitting here looking at it.
And it's hollow core. So you don't knot it, you splice it, you pass it through itself, and then it works like a Chinese finger trap.
I'm going to check this stuff out for various things.
Oh, it is the shit. They make fishing line out of it, but it's so small, it's dangerous. You don't use fishing line around a campsite because it'll just it'll open you up. It'll open an artery.
There's definitely not a lack of options for different ways to get this stuff.
No, there's a bunch of different sellers now that are selling it on like Amazon. You can get it, and eBay, you can get it. But when I built mine, it had to have been 4 or 5 years ago now. You could either order a giant roll of it yourself, or you could order it from Western Marine by the foot. And that was the cheapest way to get it, was from them. I think it was maybe 40 or 50 cents a foot for, I think I got maybe 4 millimeter might be the diameter of this. It's whatever the one with like a maybe 1600 pound breaking tensile strength, I think is 4 millimeter. I think that's what I wound up using, but it's good because it doesn't stretch like nylon would stretch. You can use polyester, but that's huge by comparison, and it eventually splinters, which is no good for your hands or for your hammock.
So, random question, how light is this stuff?
Immeasurably light.
That's what I like to hear.
It was designed first, my understanding is it was first used on racing sailboats for like really rich preppy kids.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I see a lot of marine use, so I figured that's probably where it came from.
Yeah, it absolutely is. If you're gonna do it, you want to look up, I would suggest now, because it's a lot easier to get and it's a lot cheaper, a whoopee sling is the way to go, or well, two, you know, one on each end. And then I use a UCR for my ridgeline. If you're going to use a ridgeline, I like the UCR a little bit better than the whoopee sling, but a whoopee sling uses more line, but it's much safer and it's self-cinching, whereas a UCR is a little bit trickier. You have to find a way to cinch it. It doesn't cinch itself, but it uses half the line. And a UCR is a universal constrictor rope, I think is what it's called. But you can use this stuff to make all kinds of, there's all kinds of different splices. You can make, what do they call it? A soft shackle, which replaces a carabiner. It's just as strong as a carabiner.
Ah, okay. I see what you're talking about.
Which one are you looking at? The whoopee sling or the UCR?
The UCR. I've seen a whoopee sling before.
Yeah, a UCR is nice because it's two separate lines. One passes through the other, but it doesn't self-cinch. You have to tie some type of a cinch knot to keep the thing taut at one end, or else it'll slip on you while you don't want it to.
While you're sleeping.
Yeah, exactly. And when they slip, they go all at once. So it'll start slipping just a little, and then it'll just drop you.
The definition of not fun.
Yeah, correct. Fortunately, it has not happened to me yet. I'm always careful. They tell you to milk your berries, and that is why they call the part you pass through the other line your berry. B-U-R-Y or R-R-Y. I don't know. I'm a bad speller.
Now I want to go camping.
Yeah, so do I. Even though it's like snowy outside, I really want to just get my underquilt together and give it a shot.
Up until yesterday, it was like mid-60s here. So it was actually pretty awesome. I could have went camping and been completely comfortable.
Oh, nice. Oh, we got dumped on with snow. It started snowing yesterday morning and just stopped around noon today. And we didn't get a lot of inches of snow, but we got the heaviest snow I've ever tried to move.
Yeah, thankfully, we haven't had any appreciable snow. We've had a little like a dusting here and there, but that's it. So hopefully it stays that way.
Oh, this is like our second big storm already. No, third. I'm sorry. It's our third big storm. Our first two came really early.
I was gonna say, I remember you talking earlier in the year about it just like dumping snow, and I was like, for real?
Yeah, that was unseasonably early. A lot of years we don't get snow until after Thanksgiving. That year we got it maybe even in October still.
I mean, we will usually have had at least a little snow by now. But then usually January is when we get hit the hardest. That's when we do have big snows. It's usually in January. But the last like 5 years, we really haven't had a lot of snow, just period. It's just been too warm.
Yeah. Our worst month is typically February. That's usually the coldest month anyway. I don't know if it's the worst for snow, but it's usually the coldest. But I went out snow blowing today, and most people did all their snow blowing yesterday, which in retrospect would have been a good idea because of how heavy this was. I thought if I waited, it'd be better, because usually the higher the snow is, the further my snow blower can throw it. But because it was so heavy, that was kind of the opposite this time. But going out today, everything was covered with snow. And I went out and cleaned off my bird feeder and knocked all the snow off of it. And it wound up throwing a lot of the, like a lot of seed gets dropped in the tray. and all that came out of the tray and went on the ground on top of the fresh snow, and every bird in the city saw those seeds on the ground. They don't always maybe recognize a bird feeder for what it is, but they saw the seeds on the ground. I must have had 24 birds out there at once today.
It's all about contrast. White background, dark seeds.
Yeah, exactly. And it even attracted some birds that wouldn't eat on the ground. Like I got a woodpecker eating the, I don't know how you pronounce it, the suet, whatever you pronounce that. Got a woodpecker. That was cool.
Yeah, I just hate snow because, I hate having to drive in it because I don't know what I'm doing and nobody else on the road knows what they're doing and they don't know how to take care of anything. So it's basically just a giant cluster for a week after it snows.
I've had so many rear wheel drive vehicles that I just love driving in the snow, and even a front wheel drive doesn't bother me now. Just e-brake around the corners.
If I e-brake around a corner, I'm going to careen off a hill.
Nah, you need to learn to turn into the steer. In fact, I recommend you e-brake around corners. It's the smart thing to do.
I have a winter device recommended by my brother. Have you ever heard of something called tire socks?
No.
Are those like the plastic chains or like zip ties, but chains?
According to my brother, there's something you slip over your tires rather like it was a pillow.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And then they must have like paddles on them.
Well, he's ordered four of them for his Jeep Patriot.
Yeah, our crews up here in the Northeast are efficient enough that we really don't need those devices. You would think we would because we get a lot of snow, but we got so much gear up here to deal with it already. And you know if it gets that bad, you just put snow tires on and they're worth it because you wear them for 6 months, 5 months. But no, I mean it, Taj, it's a good idea to start e-braking around corners just so you can learn how to drive out of it, so when it happens and you're not expecting it, it'll be instinct. It's like training at the dojo.
I'd rather just not drive when it snows.
Yeah, but you don't always have that option.
No, if it snows at all, everything shuts down.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, like nothing is open when it snows here. It's kind of comical. Like it will be probably to everywhere else in the world, a trivial amount of snow. And everybody's just like closed for 2 days. Like that nobody can handle it here.
Well, like I said, we have the gear to handle it. And I could certainly understand a place further south not having that gear. It's just not going to be in your budget if you don't use it as much. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of maintenance just to keep that stuff running.
I mean, they'll plow the road and they'll throw some salt out and like probably say a couple prayers while they're doing it to hope that it does something, but yeah, it doesn't really do a whole lot.
Oh, yeah, I was just thinking, my uncle who came from West Virginia worked at Goddard and lived in Laurel, Maryland. He was very amused by Washington, D.C. and 2 inches of snow. How it just took the entire Capitol and turned it off.
I was in D.C. one time, heading out of it, actually heading for home, and just got on the highway in July, I think, maybe August. And a storm came in and it threw down like 2 inches of hail. And that was not amusing at all.
No, that just sucks.
2 inches of ball bearings on the road. Yeah, I can see that.
It was like everywhere you looked, it was like somebody spilled their cooler. It was incredible.
Well, I remember going to Maine some Christmas and it was icy and the people in the right lane were creeping along. And this little Volkswagen goes bombing by in the left lane on the main turnpike. Few miles later, he wasn't going so fast when he was leaned up against the median strip.
Oh, it used to be a very common sight up here to see big trucks spun out in the middle or off to the side because they would put it in four-wheel drive and not realize you've got to take it out of four-wheel drive when you go on the highway. And they wouldn't realize that, and they'd be spun out all the time. But everybody has all-wheel drive now, so people, and I'm a pretty fast driver, but in the snow and in the slippery conditions, I'm fairly cautious. But people even fly by me regularly, and I don't see them spun out. All-wheel drive seems to be an active stability control and stuff. It seems to work really well because it's the same idiots.
Yeah. You listen to a professional trucker about four-wheelers, and you'd swear that these guys got their driver's license in a Cracker Jack box.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I try to stay away from the highways. I try to stick to back roads whenever I can.
Well, my brother was given his first automatic truck. You know, it's got a 10-speed or something, but it's automatic, computerized. And this one being a Volvo, with a Volvo transmission, they're integrated very well. His previous truck's transmission was not integrated very well because it was like a Peterbilt and Allison transmission or whatnot, and they just didn't bother harmonizing them.
Quick, somebody say Happy New Year.
Happy New Year! Somebody.
Anybody.
I don't have the thing this year. I forget where I even had it before, where you could see which countries and time zones were switching over at which Happy New Year. We used to say Happy New Year to who it was, but I forget where that came from.
I think I have it, and I think I'm reading it correctly. So according to this, Brazil, Uruguay, okay, that's it. It says and one more, but doesn't list who the one more is, so I don't know who it is.
Well, it could be someone.
Brazil, Uruguay, and Brazil adjacent.
Well, then they have a bunch of cities, and they're like, I think they're all in Brazil, so I don't know what this means.
Well, there's also like Trinidad or something that might be included.
And Brazil's greedy, like us in America. Like they're also part of the next one, so you know.
Yeah, well, they're sort of like Alaska South. Also, what was really cute is when I was running DOS and dial-up and whatnot, I would be downloading programs from Trinidad and Tobago users group. I had all of the world to choose from, and some of my best stuff came from this tiny little, well, relatively tiny users group.
Hey, if they got the stuff, they got the stuff.
Yep. One of my other treasures here is a 1991 internet travel log. This guy got the contract, or sort of, for converting ISO's internet standards to PDF and something that people could actually read from their random hacked together crap. And he also set up a Sun server that put these PDFs and whatnot on the internet for OpenFTP. The ISO would charge you an arm and a leg for their documents and made it rather difficult to get a hold of. Also, they had a friendly relationship with their local printers. So every year they would come out with another truckload of documents because of whose high price. They hadn't sold last year's yet. But after a lot of developing nations started downloading the stuff, the ISO woke up and said, wait a minute. If they download the stuff for free, they're not paying us exorbitant rates for the paper copy. So the ISO unpublished their standards.
That sounds about right.
Also, the ISO was into their own standards and, you know, X25 and whatnot. And what they hated was TCP/IP, because that came from America and ARPA and was an open standard and actually worked. And they had their grand plan for the 7-layer model, of which they only produced 7 large layers of paperwork. And when their model was that there should be only 256 networks in the world, because their model was the network would be provided by the telephone company, and anyone who wanted to transmit data would would have to, you know, pay the toll.
Funny how they keep trying to go back to that. Like, it seems like a constant battle to try to get us to that point.
Well, also, at this time, he goes around the world to various people who are actually connecting Hawaii with Japan, Singapore. By the way, the Singapore had a tremendous data processing problem. The bookies required magnificent layer after layer of super minis to handle their bets. Also, Singapore had ISDN telephone, so you could plug your laptop right into a high-speed internet connection. Thank you very much at any payphone. But it was interesting seeing how this guy going around the world a couple of times to see various people who were fighting their way to get their nations networked and to open portals to the newly freed Balkans and Soviet bloc, you know, former Soviet nations and everything. Meanwhile, the agency who was supposed to do all this stuff, attached to the UN, was fighting a valiant rearguard action against TCP/IP, and a lot of times their X-25 traffic was X-25 or whatever was blessed by government, but the actual packets were good old TCP/IP, and you know, they were only using the foreign stuff, I mean the ISO stuff, because that was what was decreed, including by the US government. The fact that very few people listened to the government on this standard was really a good thing. It was interesting, one guy had an office and he had a blow up skeleton, which was his skeleton staff. And they had pictures of the console for some of the IMPs and TIPs, which were the original ARPANET interface processors. The console was a first generation Mac hidden inside a steel roller case. But then when I was at UMass in the late 70s, early 80s, I saw a computer that had been donated. It was clearly a mil-spec device. I don't know if anyone had the password, but we had a real problem accessing the device. The case was built by Mosler. It was not only probably may have been a drum computer, but how do you get at the machine if it's got this safe type dial on the front panel? I mean, before you get to the front panel.
So basically putting it in a safe.
Yep, the case was made by Mosler, the safe company. Somebody clearly donated a machine which they had no use for. And they got a tax credit, and it was buried deep in the bowels of UMass and may still be there.
Things like that tend to be running some sort of like critical infrastructure thing that nobody remembers what it is until it dies.
This was not attached to anything. Although, speaking of critical infrastructure, somebody shipped us a whole bunch of discrete negative logic PDP-8s, 4K units. Evidently, they were the disc control, the drum controllers for like a PDP-20 or something. These machines came with a front panel, 4 kilowords of memory, and a weight that would give anyone a hernia. But we had no peripherals, no nothing.
Wouldn't give me a hernia. My back's already so screwed up, I couldn't even stress that hard against it.
Well, I'm trying to work mine through. Well, since leaving treatment, I've been dealing with some depression and and it tended to have me stay in bed too much. And my back is now, I'm trying to negotiate a new contract with my back.
The inversion table has been doing wonders for mine, and the occasional muscle relaxer as well is very nice.
Well, I may have to see where I can get an inversion table and then see where I can work on it.
There's dozens of them on Craigslist in your local area. People buy them, they pay too much for them, and then they wind up stop using them. But yeah, you can pick them up. You might want a friend to help you actually lift the thing, because they are pretty heavy. And there's a couple of videos online about using them. But the basic trick is to try and limit them at first. You really don't need to go full inversion. You don't need to give yourself a headache. If you can just get a couple degrees past, you know, parallel with the floor, it's going to have some effect on you. And then you work your way into it. Like the first day, you do like 15 seconds. And the second day, you maybe try to go for 30 seconds. And you work your way up that way. You don't go for like 15 minutes and sit-ups on your first day. That's how people hurt themselves and get sick of it.
Well, I would have to find somebody. Yeah, I've got a couple of jobs like that.
And most of them come with a tether, so you can limit how far you go over on the thing. And you can just, you know, tether it to go to, you know, 10 or 15 degrees beyond parallel. At first, that's all you need. And that, even that's going to make a difference. What it does, the inversion table, is it pulls your discs, pulls your vertebrae apart a little bit, and it puts a little bit of negative pressure on your vertebrae. And just that little bit of negative pressure and then compressing again is enough to pump fluid in and out of them, because there's no active pumping system for the fluid and the lubricants around your discs.
Yeah, actually, I've had a pinched nerve, and it was interesting spending 20 minutes a couple of times a week being hung by a very lovely physical therapist. Now, I was hung on a slope, so it wasn't too bad, but still.
Yeah, all my physical therapists just laid me flat and used a big leather belt that they wrapped behind my knees, and then they would just lean back on it. They never put me in an incline.
Well, if I get myself together, I may have to see about going to some kind of therapy to see what's going on.
The couple things that I did before I got the inversion table, you can lean back on a table, just lock your arms straight behind you and lean back on like a low table, like a desk, and kind of make a sitting position with your legs. That takes some weight off your back. That's pretty good. When things were real bad for me, I was told not to get an inversion table because it was right after the surgery. I got crutches, and I just leaned on crutches for a while, because even that will take some weight off your back. But a lot of the things you learn at physical therapy, you can do, like just walking back and forth, the different sweeps they have you do with your legs and stuff. You can do that in a swimming pool, like at the YMCA, and even that has a lot of positive effect if you do it routinely.
Well, I'm going to have to see. I find that if I'm up enough and just keep changing position from sitting to standing to kneeling up on the bed, that kind of thing, tends to unlock the back after a bit.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. If I stay in bed too long, it hurts real bad.
Yeah, my brother has said that, you know, sometimes he's got a bad back being a trucker, and he said, you know, just laying on the floor, sort of in a fetal position, has helped his back sometimes.
Oh yeah, my disc does not bulge that way. The fetal position is one of the worst positions for me.
Well, I think mine is largely a muscle, hopefully not a disc problem, but more of muscle issues.
Wow, muscle issues are easy. Just throw booze at it.
Well, that tends to be discouraged when you're taking 60 milligrams of Prozac.
That's probably a fair point.
Well, my cat has stopped snoring here. You know, it's interesting. My cat's getting old enough to snore. Also, I can tell when I've been sleeping very deeply is the cat will show up on my chest or nearby. And when I'm a restless sleeper, the cat stays out of my way.
That's funny because my cat has snored since he was a kitten.
Well, I have a tuxedo cat that's getting up there in years.
We got a cat. My cat's like 7 years old, maybe. And my wife just got another cat who's probably 2 or 3 years old. And it's really funny because I can see where the term copycat came from, because they're picking up each other's habits.
Well, one of the fellows that I follow on YouTube this spring picked up a Maine Coon kitten.
Those are typically pretty friendly cats, but I don't think I'll ever have another long hair cat. There's just too much work.
Well, a friend of mine who had one lived in an apartment, and she saw this cat out in the hall, and he said, "Oh, one of my neighbors has got a kitten." One of her friends says, "No, that's a normal sized cat." Between the long hair and their general big bone structure, huge.
Yeah, they're all over the place up here, being so close to Maine.
In what end of civilization are you?
I'm in the southern end of New Hampshire.
Yeah, well, I'm south of Boston. And I used to believe that I moved into civilization when I crossed the bridge at Kittery, headed north.
Yeah, I don't know if I can agree with that. Those maniacs are maniacs.
Well, my folks, one was from West Virginia in a very patriarchal family, and my mother was from Maine, if anything, is a little on the matrilineal side. And they were married, and my mother's queen of boiled dinners, and my dad is used to southern cooking. It was definitely one of those things where heaven made them and the devil matched them. And one of the things that they were clear on was since both of them had their names on the deed, they owned the house, and their children had no investment in it. So going to my grandparents in Maine and West Virginia, where I was actually welcome, was a very important fact. Probably saved my somewhat battered sanity.
Whereabouts in Maine?
Belgrade and up in Weld, Maine. My mother's original farm was taken for Mount Blue State Park.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with either of those towns. Those must be up there pretty far.
Well, the Belgrade Lakes is about 15 miles from Augusta. And yeah, Weld is up near Mount Blue State Park, the Rangeley Lakes area.
All right.
Which is sort of Midwestern Maine.
Yeah, Maine is actually a gigantic state if you try to move through it, if you try to drive through it. It's enormous.
Yes. On my grandmother's farm up there, there was at one time a grass airstrip running along the ridgeline. One of the larger crimes that I heard of was the fact that the family carved up that 360-acre farm. They probably lost only maybe a million five. If you advertised a farm like that in like New York City, where some rich guy could come up there and had a barn and stuff on it, you know, with half an airstrip, but they had to have their little pieces of the rock.
Howdy, everyone. So, weird random pop quiz question. Maine is the only state that actually borders one other state. Everyone else either borders more or none in the case of Alaska and Hawaii.
Indeed. Zoc, you might want to turn your mic up a little bit.
I'm on the phone, so I'm not sure I can. I will see what I can do.
That helped a little, just getting a little closer, whatever you just did.
Yell basically right into the phone.
That's doing it. That sounds better.
Well, there we go. How's everyone going?
Good, man. How you been?
Busy. It's been a weird few months. Not going to go into a ton of personal stuff, just things happening, life happening, nothing bad, just, you know, marriages, people moving out and just a bunch of stuff like that. So it's just been really busy, but it's nothing, like I said, nothing bad. It's all good. It's just been busy.
What moving out said?
Oh, Minizuk got married and moved out of the house and took the cat with him. So that was a bit of an adjustment. To no longer have it. Not Captain Underpants, Minizuk. I mean, he did like Captain Underpants.
No shit, has it been that long? I liked Captain Underpants myself.
yeah, it really has been that long. He is now married. He is over the age of 18. He is a homeowner.
Holy smokes. Time flies, man.
Yeah, no, I've been doing HPR for, what, 11 years now or something? I mean, it is crazy. Well, I've been doing HPR for 11 years. I mean, I've been showing up for the New Year's show the last few years. I'm behind on my shows. So sorry, Ken. But yes.
You and me both.
I had recorded one earlier, but I sound terrible because I'm getting over this horrible lurgy thing that seemed to be going around, and I still think I'm about a quarter octave down from where I normally am. I sound weird. And for someone who hates the sound of his own voice, especially recorded, it's really not fun. But I have a response to a Klaatu episode he did talking about setting up his own like tiny URL version, and I'm just going to do an episode on that, which the short version is you get yourself a domain, the free domain or some other way, and you go to a website called short.cm, so the word short, Sierra Hotel Oscar Romeo Tango period Charlie Mike, and they will let you do a URL shortener through them. There are certain limitations on the free one. You know, you can only do 1,000. Oh, darn. 1,000 at once, that is. But you can do your own ones. So I got to remember what I set up now. But I can't remember what I did. I set one up for HPR and it bounces you to HPR. But it's like you go to the website and it's like / upload virus or something. Because, you know, I could.
Oh, you're so cheeky, Zoc.
Yeah, I had a rather eventful... Well, spring and fall.
Give me one moment. I'll see if I can find it.
Yep, he found an uploaded virus. All right, disconnected and right off the server.
Well, this year, inspecting my property for some future work, the town found a leak in my water line, so they promptly cut it and ran a garden hose from a hole in the street to my house, which recently got replaced with the an all-weather copper line. Along the way, my front lawn got basically removed, and some other stuff got rearranged, including getting rid of the last of my wisteria hedge and a barberry bush, which was, as far as I was concerned, just a thorn bush. So now I have a bald front lawn.
Did you say you were from south of Boston, as in Massachusetts, or Austin, as in Texas?
I am south of Boston, down on the fringes of the MBTA system.
Gotcha. Okay. I just posted a world time zone map in the chat there. It's not the best one. It's not as good as the one we've had in years before, but it seems to be the best one that comes up on DuckDuckGo right now. Which, by the way, since it's like a random topic type of show, can I throw some love at DuckDuckGo?
Go for it.
Always. DuckDuckGo is awesome.
It really is. This thing, it you know, forgive me for saying so, but it used to be crap, and I avoided it for years because it just, it was no good. At least for me, it wasn't. Maybe I just didn't know the right invocations to get it to search for me. But, you know, I did an install of Mint recently that was a fresh install, so it didn't take all of my preset settings with it, and it just happened to be on DuckDuckGo, and man, does it work good. It is better than Google for a large number of tasks. Specifically looking for album art, it is way better than Google at finding album art and giving you a usable picture. But even just for regular searches, it is absolutely usable, fully functional. It is my search engine of choice now, and that's all I have to say about that.
Evening, folks.
Hey, FXB, how you doing?
All right, man. Yeah, I got here a little late to the party, but midnight with friends, so I thought it's drunk.
Well, it's the kind of thing that people go in and out of all night long, so I don't think there is such a thing as a late, but I don't believe we've met before, so nice to meet you, FXB.
We may have done some years, but it's been a long while since I've been on the HPR New Year's Eve show, so it's good to see you, man.
What have you been up to lately? Anything? Anything interesting for an HPR crowd?
Sort of been a new job the last 3 years, dealt a lot with containers, Docker, fun times. Still trying to get my head around Kubernetes, but that's all covered a lot in other places. So yeah, man. Yeah, it's sort of fun times all around, I think.
Yeah, I've had a new job, not new anymore, but 5 years ago I changed jobs and my whole world kind of changed. And I barely get a chance to mess around with Linux anymore. I work with Windows all day long, and the last thing I want to do is use a computer when I get home. So I've gotten so much worse at it.
Oh, my sympathies, man. The gig I've been the last 3 years, I've been very, very lucky. Sort of almost everything we've got is in no small part thanks to my influence is mostly Ubuntu. I think it's our marketing department still all Windows and one or two Macs. So
it's still pretty cool that other people at your work are using Linux. That's fairly awesome.
I looked into one of those situations where a company is at a certain point and they're really trying to grow, and the one thing they wanted to do was save a lot of money. So they were like, hey, we can run our stuff and not have that extra for this. Oh, that's okay then, let's do that.
One thing I'm hoping to dig into real soon now, I know, sounds like a New Year's resolution, is GNOME boxes. It sounds like a cool technology, but seems rather under-documented.
I've not dealt with that before. Can you describe it, please?
Well, it is, on the basis, it's basically a virtualization system like VirtualBox, based on Linux tools and Linux environment. It also is supposedly having communication channels to other GNOME boxes installations on other machines. I haven't played with it much. However, I do know that Vert Manager provides a lot of the nuts and bolts tweaking that GNOME by itself, being a minimalist construction, does not provide out of the box.
That sounds extremely useful.
I use it, but I don't do anything special with it. It's usually just to like boot an ISO or something. So I mean, to me, I use it just like I would have used VirtualBox, but I hear it can do a lot cooler things under the hood.
So what is it, like abstraction between GNOME shell and virtual machine? Or
no, I mean, I use it to spin up virtual machines. I mean, that's all I use it for, but there is supposedly more plumbing underneath it to Netminer was talking about, to like wire together virtual environments and stuff like that. It's just, that's not the use case I use it for.
And it's, again, you look at their web page and there's, the documentation is very minimal. I mean, someone might be able to prove that all the information is there, but digging it out requires a certain amount of spelunky. And the fact that a lot of the VirtualBox tools have to be provided by Virt Manager going in and tweaking the package produced by Boxes itself makes things considerably hairy.
It sounds like interesting tech, nonetheless.
Yeah, well, since most of my machines that are regularly used are multi-core, have fat memories because they were designed to eventually do VM service, that is, VM host. I really like the Virt Manager, and I like the fact that it uses Spice and WebDAV in place of the more proprietary VirtualBox tools, guest editions.
Yeah, so it's abstracting things out nicely.
It does reasonably nicely. Again, the documentation is pretty limited, and you have to boot a machine, freeze it, and then you can tweak it. You can't set up easily a template like you can with VirtualBox or a lot of other virtualization solutions, and then populate the template that you've built. It starts up what it thinks it needs, and then you have to stop it and go in and get out the spanner.
I got you. You got to sort of build out your own environment from a starting point.
Right, and the starting point is whatever whatever Boxes considers its starting point. Again, underdocumented. There may be a configuration file somewhere, but it's not a straightforward process. But since I'm running Linux and I don't need a lot of the cross-platform stuff that is in VirtualBox, I'd much rather work with a Linux on Linux solution, or at least one that's somewhat Linux on Linux or BSD on Linux or what have you.
Yeah, everything's in a familiar environment. I got you, Matt. Since I got here late, has Ken been dipping in and dipping out, or is he just not around at the moment?
I haven't heard from Ken all day, but I've been kind of in and out.
About, 7 or 8 hours ago, I was talking to him.
Fair enough. Because, yeah, I actually ran into him at Odd Camp this year, and it was sort of, hey, man, yeah, sorry, it's been like 11 years and I still owe you a show. Whoops.
Okay, so I can't actually find it. Short.cm, it looks like they're actually having issues. It won't let me log in. But I did set up a short link, and I can't find it. So, yeah, ho-hum. Technology is here to just try us sometimes.
It is indeed.
But then again, if it worked all the time, I wouldn't have had a job. So I've spent my career either writing or fixing stuff. So... I'm still doing that at my current job, working on stuff. So that seems to be how it's going. We're massively Windows, though. We are. I work for an education company, I will say. But basically, Microsoft a stupidly good deal because we're education. We get Office 365 for free, basically. There is some licensing fees that. But it costs us like 70-80 grand a year, which we have to pay anyway for licensing stuff, the Windows desktop and stuff, and everything else is thrown in basically. So we get 1,000 licenses here, 10,000 of these, 5,000 of those, depending what it is. We have infinite licenses for staff and students. Literally, I can go into Office 365 and it's you have licensed however many of infinite. So it's kind of it kind of skews the things like, well, we could do Linux, but it costs the same just to do Windows, and that ties into everything else we have, so let's do that.
Youch.
Zoke, are you using Plumble?
Yes, I am. I'm running around my phone, so yeah, it probably sounds fairly terrible.
No, it actually sounds really good.
It's really surprising that you're using your phone and it sounds that good.
It's the best I've heard Plumble sound.
It's one of the joys It's one of the joys of Mumble, I've found. It doesn't seem to matter what client you use. As long as you're in the right environment, it sounds very, very good.
Are you using a wired headset or a Bluetooth?
I'm yelling at the phone. My mouth is half an inch from the phone. It didn't sound too well when I said normally. So I have the phone held upside down. I'm talking, like I said, half an inch from what traditionally would be the microphone end of the speaker. The microphone end of the handset. But so I'm sort of yelling at that. But yeah, that's it. I'm nothing special at all.
Well, actually, yeah, most people try to use headsets, and that's where you get problems.
That's why he keeps muting it, because otherwise the speaker kicks off his voice activation, or actually might even be always on, but keep getting echoes.
Yeah, I think it's always on, so I just mute, which is kind of annoying. But
you can turn on push to talk.
It's really hard to do that with the touch screen when you're not staring right at it if you're doing something. And if he's trying to use his hands, I get why he's muting it.
Okay.
Actually, one thing I found that worked quite well a while back is if you're on an Android phone, there is now an application in there. I forget the name of it, but if you've got a phone that has several available physical keys, you can remap them. And I had a phone, I actually remapped one of those as my push-to-talk key in Plumble.
No kidding. What's that app?
Give me a second. I'm going to go find out the name of it. It is in F-Droid.
Do you need to be rooted?
Oddly, there is an option in Plumble that does say use hardware keys. So I don't know how well that works.
Hardware keys, especially those outside the sort of what Android accepts to be there, are a funny thing, but this application lets you remap them no matter what they are. I'm just going to go to F and find out what it is so I can tell you guys.
Now, Zoke, you say you're running around. Are you running around the house and you're on Wi-Fi, or are you doing this on a cell network?
Oh, no, Wi-Fi. I'm running around. My daughter is listening to I don't know what Disney show on her tablet. I ran to the other end of the house, so I sort of flit in and out. I'm on Wi-Fi. It's a Google Home Hub thing, the original one anyway. We're on, can't remember, it's like actually the cheapest they offer, but it's like 100 meg connection down and I think 10 up.
It's frozen, by the way. She's listening to Frozen on her tablet.
You know that for definite? Or are
you said, guessing? You said Disney, you said and daughter. Disney and daughter.
I will go and see if you're right.
Okay. If I'm not, just pretend you didn't go look.
Okay, the app I mentioned is actually literally called eMapper. I will post the link in the Mumble chat if nobody minds.
There was a time, and it feels like it was not long ago, that I knew every application in the F-Droid store.
F-Droid's funny. There will be long periods where you will see the occasional update to stuff you use regularly, and then nothing new, and then occasionally something new pops up. KeyMapper is actually a fairly recent one.
So can you use it, like say you're using Plumble, like Zoke's doing now, can you map your power or your screen on and off key to be the push-to-talk key just while Plumble is open, or does it change it permanently, or is it just not going to work at all because you can't remap the screen key?
It depends on both the key and the application. So if the key would normally be used for something built into whatever launcher or build of Android that your device comes with, you don't need to be rooted to use. You can't get functionality out of that. But you can usually bind a physical key to an app, a shortcut exposed by an application, like to talk with Plumble, or you can also bind a long press on the physical key to launch an application.
That sounds pretty cool. I am actually going to draw. Can't change any of the settings whilst I'm running. Actively connect to a server, apparently. It's not frozen. It is some show clots where like storks deliver babies or something, and they, I don't know, just something. So, yes, Frozen.
Thanks, Zoke.
Okay.
I knew I could count on him.
Oh, man, I haven't heard of Zoke for weeks.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.